Richard Spur, but next, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will hear about the latest revelations of Prince Andrew's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and the case of the alleged spies for China at the heart of the British establishment. We'll talk about the London mosque banning females over 12 from entering into what was called a family-friendly, inclusive fun run, and about the government directing universities to tackle anti-Semitism on campus. We'll get the latest from the Gaza ceasefire and check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, the autumn budget could see higher taxes levelled on the rich. Are they not the most logical people to help the country out of the fix it's in? Or will they just leave, as those who represent the rich always threaten? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. President Trump has left the US on Air Force One, bound for talks in Egypt on his peace plan for the Middle East. The multinational gathering is due to be held at Sharm el-Sheikh and will also include the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. In the last half hour, Donald Trump told reporters all sides of the argument were supporting his efforts.
Usually if you have one cheering, the other isn't. The other is the opposite. This is the first time everybody is amazed and they're thrilled, and it's an honor to be involved, and we're going to have an amazing time, and it's going to be something that's never happened before.
It's expected Keir Starmer will commit the UK to playing a key role in rebuilding Gaza tomorrow. He's due to make the offer during the Egypt peace talks. It's also believed he will praise President Trump for his work on ending the war between Israel and Hamas. Israel's been confirming no Palestinian prisoners will be released as part of the Washington peace plan until all of their hostages have been returned. It's understood the 20 living captives will be freed as a group by Hamas early tomorrow morning. The Conservatives are expected to submit an urgent question in the House of Commons over the government's handling of a court case which saw two men accused of spying for China. Prosecutors say they had to drop it because they couldn't obtain evidence which would have labelled Beijing as a national security threat. Ministers have blamed the previous Conservative government. France's newly reappointed Prime Minister has named a new government this evening. Sébastien Lecornu is facing pressure to urgently produce a budget and limit the country's ongoing political turmoil, which is damaging its economy and reputation. But LBC's correspondent in Paris, Peter Allen, says the government's creation may not change anything.
At the moment, we have a hung parliament here in Paris because the people are hugely divided. And because of that, an incumbent prime minister at the moment cannot get a coalition together to pass legislation. That means that any real governance has to be done by the president through presidential decree, which is hugely undemocratic and hugely unpopular.
And in sports, Scotland are guaranteed a top two finish in World Cup qualifying Group C after a 2-1 win over Belarus. They'll at least be in the playoffs following Denmark's 3-1 victory over Greece. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in western areas overnight. Cloudier for the east, though, with patchy fog across England and Scotland. We'll see a low of 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC, from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. A cabinet minister dropped a heavy hint today that Labour is on the verge of axing the two-child benefit cap. Also expected in the autumn budget is that the wealthy will be targeted to fill an estimated £30 billion black hole in the public finances. Now, who better to talk about this than a wealthy person? Julia Davis is co-founder of Patriotic Millionaires UK, a group of wealthy individuals calling for the tax burden to be directed more towards wealth. Good evening, Julia.
Good evening.
Just on the subject of tax in general, people seem to want the winter fuel payment kept, they want the two-child benefit cap lifted, they want pensions, triple lock kept, they want more money for the NHS, they want more police, better services, and they also want to pay less tax. These things aren't compatible, are they?
Well, they're not compatible in terms of we have got to get that money from somewhere. And it's right that people want to have high standards of living in Britain because we're a country that's got an awful lot of wealth. So we need to be looking at getting the investment to pay for all of these things, which people quite rightly want, from where the money is. And as an organisation, you know, we are well aware that, over quite a long period of time, there's been a concentration of wealth into the hands of fewer and fewer people. So if we want to, you know, bring these standards up for, everybody in Britain, then we need to follow the money. And for a long time, we've been requiring people who are going out to work to pay tax and contribute to all of these things. But we haven't been taxing where the money really is enough. So if you go out to work, you can only work a certain number of hours in a week. So how much you're able to contribute in tax from what you earn is limited. But there are many people now who have considerable amount of wealth, which they're able to invest to make more money. And so we have proposals which we just think that we should be taxing that more fairly, because we absolutely need to be improving our NHS, making sure that our pensioners are well looked after, and providing our young people with the support for the future that they absolutely deserve. So our proposals are very moderate. And whenever we go out and we regularly poll people in Britain about whether or not they support our proposals, and they overwhelmingly do, including people would have to pay a bit of extra in tax along the lines that we propose. So fundamentally, we believe that income from all sources should be taxed at the same rate. So there's no justification for taxing income from wealth at a lower rate than income from going out to work. And we propose a very moderate tax on wealth above £10 million of 2%. And that will provide some of the investment which we really do need as a country now to make sure that everyone, you know, benefits from the fact that, as I said, we are a wealthy country. It's just, unfortunately, at the moment, the wealth of Britain is only benefiting a small proportion of people. And it should be supporting, you know, everyone in Britain.
There's some evidence to suggest that actually we're not a wealthy country. We have a wealthy city, but if you take Greater London out of the equation, we're quite a poor country, really, aren't we?
No, we don't. We have a lot of wealth, but as I said, it's been concentrated into the hands of fewer and fewer people. So over the period that the Sunday Times Rich List has been published, there's been a vast transfer of wealth from everyone, from public wealth, into the hands of fewer and fewer people. So back when that was first published, you know, we had considerable net public wealth. Last time I looked at it, we were then a trillion in debt as a public as a whole, whereas the wealthiest in society, their wealth's been going up and up and up. So the 40 wealthiest families in Britain have more wealth between them than half of all British people. So that's 40 families with more wealth than about 33.5 million people. Is that right? So, you know, the money is there. It's just being concentrated. And when it's concentrated in that way, it's not surprising that people in Britain are feeling worse off, because they are, most of them are worse off. It's just some of them are considerably better off. And so the proposals that we have, you know, that's not going to stop people being wealthy, all their wealth going up. It's just going to provide a little bit of the contribution that we need, so that we're not continuing to sort of make things harder for small to medium sized businesses, as happened when we put up employers' national insurance. And we're not making people who are already going out to work, struggling to pay the bills, struggling to put food on the table, making them pay a bit more tax because very, very wealthy people aren't being asked to make the contribution which they can absolutely make without it making a dot of, you know, any difference to the way that they live their lives.
10 million is quite a large sum, though. How many people have that kind of money?
Well, that's the great thing about it. Not that many, but enough. But between them, they have a lot of money. So that means it's a tax that absolutely could be applied. It would be really good use of HMRC resources to implement this tax and bring in some of the revenue. So the revenue that this would bring in, it would make a considerable contribution to the black hole that we keep hearing about. And there's just no need for it. The money is there. The will is there, because the British people have shown time and time again that they support this. So it sounds really positive. It sounds like, you know, the government are starting to listen to the British people with regard to this, and that's really good. And as patriotic millionaires, we're going to be in Westminster next week trying to make our voices heard, because we're hearing a lot about patriotism in UK at the moment. Patriotism from wealthy people is being willing to contribute to the country that they live in, that's enabled them to make the wealth that they have in many cases, and to support their fellow Brits. You know, like I said, you know, we all know that we really want to look after our pensioners well. We want our kids to have the education that they need. We live in challenging times. We need to invest in our you know, our defence. We know that we've had problems with our criminal justice system. All of that requires money, and that money should be coming from where money is concentrated, and that is from the wealthiest in Britain.
You would need their cooperation, though, wouldn't you? And it seems, I mean, you know, I applaud you for your stance on this, but it's, to the naked eye, it does look as though the more money you have, the more you pull every trick you possibly can to keep more and more of it. And if you're talking about people who have over £10 million, then presumably that's not just an old lady who's sitting in a big house that she bought for £10,000 70 years ago in Notting Hill. It's somebody who has liquid assets, and those kind of people can just up sticks and leave.
They can, but they don't tend to. The evidence doesn't suggest that, although there's been lots of sort of, I would say, inaccurate stories in the news to suggest that they do. People like living in Britain. People want to live in Britain because it's a great place to live, despite what certain people want to tell us at the moment. You know, they want to bring their children up here. They want to enjoy our great sort of culture. And it's a good place to live. You know, and not all assets can be moved. But, you know, these things can be dealt with. With the will, they can be dealt with. You know, we could have an exit tax, which means that money can't just be taken out of the country. So with forward thinking, these things can be addressed. And we've been told for too long that that taxing wealth would, you know, wouldn't be in our interests. But actually, you know, we need to try new things now. It's not been working the way things have been going for a very long time, and we've ended up in a situation where I think everyone is feeling pretty fed up with the way things have gone. But they don't need to. We live in a fantastic country. We have great talent in Britain, and we should be willing to support it. And there's another thing, is we shouldn't just accept this, that it's okay for people who can contribute more to say that actually we don't want to. Because when they say that, what they're saying is that they are willing for, you know, basically our NHS to fail. They're willing for us not to have the money to fund everything that we need in the UK. Or they think that people who already are contributing an awful lot out of their wages, small to medium sized businesses are already contributing a lot and struggling, that they should be the people that pay more, rather than the people that can really afford it. And as a society, we shouldn't say, you know, we shouldn't just accept that, because I'd say that's morally wrong. And it's not actually good for our economy. It's good for our economy when we support small to medium sized businesses, when we support people who are going out to work, and we support the people who are holding up our NHS, who are keeping our schools running. And we don't just keep pushing them.
Everything that you're saying sort of goes against the grain of Britishness, really, because one of the main industries is to hide the ill-gotten gains of the international criminal super-rich. I mean, maybe I'm just exaggerating slightly for comic effect, but that's what we do, isn't it? If you look at the top 10 tax havens in the world, I think 7 of them have the Union Jack fluttering from the government building. So asking people to sort of reverse this this mindset of ever more acquisitiveness and hiding your wealth from the tax person, it's almost not patriotic.
I couldn't agree with you less. I don't think that's British at all. I think as a nation, we can be proud that we do, despite what a lot of people want to tell us at the moment. I think we are a caring nation. I think we are a nation who cares about each other. I think we are a proud nation, and not in the way that's being portrayed by certain people at the moment. Unfortunately, there are those who profit from this, and who that's their business, and they want us to think that that is normal human behaviour. I just don't accept that. I think most people are caring. Most people want to ensure that our pensioners are well looked after, that our kids get a good chance in life. I think that they care about, you know, our natural world. They want us to have, you know, like to have, you know, like lovely cities that they can enjoy to be in, and that they're happy for their kids to go out at night and not worry about them. I believe that's what true British nature is. And I don't think we should accept that we are just extremely selfish and just out for ourselves. And if that hurts us, then that's okay, because we followed that way of just being sort of dog eat dog. I don't believe that that is human nature. And I don't believe that's what British people are about.
Okay, so how would we go about persuading or enforcing the people who have assets of over £10 million to give up What is your suggestion? Is it 1%, something like that?
So our proposal is for a wealth tax of 2% on wealth above 10 million. So if you had 11 million, then that would be 20k a year, which would be a tiny percentage of the wealth that you have. We go about persuading people to do that in the same way that we go about persuading working people to pay income tax and, you know, businesses to pay employers NI.
Well, they're,
you know,
not persuaded. They're not persuaded. They're forced by
exactly.
Threat of jail.
So why do we suggest that any different approach should be taken to wealthy people? You know, wealthy people shouldn't be treated anymore. We keep talking about it as if this is somehow sort of asking them to do something which we don't already ask working people to do. So we don't go cap in hand to working people and say, please, can you pay your income tax? You know, so tax has got to come from somewhere if we want to, you know, as you said, if we want high standard health services, if we want to maintain safe streets, if we want our kids to get the education that they deserve, that's got to come from somewhere. And it's right that it should come from where the wealth is.
But how would you determine how much somebody has in wealth? Would you not just be precipitating scenes in Belgravia where enormously well-shod people are on paper paupers?
Well, they would be committing tax fraud if they didn't declare it. So you'd require them to declare their wealth in the same way as we require wealth to be declared when somebody dies. So when someone dies, you know, you have to account for the wealth that they had. And presumably, if we're going to have a wealth tax, we would require wealthy people to account for the wealth that they had. And they would be, you know, lying to the tax man if they didn't say what they had.
But what do you say to people that, I mean, the usual refrain is that the rich pay, I don't know what the percentage is, so let's say 50, the top 5,000 people pay 50% of all the income tax in the country. And of course, the argument to that is that wealthy don't make their money through their income. It's not wages, it's the increase in the value of their assets. But those people can, and in some cases do, leave. The Instagram of the rich in Dubai is absolutely chock-a-block with ex-Brits. So how are you going to prevent that?
As I said, I think that the idea that wealthy people are going to leave because of this, I think that's overstated. People want to be in Britain because it's a good place to live. I think a lot of people, you know, some people may want be willing to move to Dubai. I don't think that many are or will, but obviously the ones that do and the ones that are that determined not to contribute to Britain because they care about their fellow Brits so little, you know, they do talk about it, they talk it up. And let's remember that there's a whole industry out there which is all about helping people to move around the world to avoid contributing to a safe and functioning society in the society which enabled them to make their wealth in the first place.
Yeah, mostly based in London, surely.
Yeah, but most people aren't like that. I really don't believe that most people are like that. I think most people want to live in a good, functioning, safe society, which they can be proud of. And I think they are willing to contribute to that, as our polls have shown. So our polls have consistently shown that the majority of people, including people with wealth, are willing to pay a bit more tax so that they're not so worried about the condition of their country and that they can see things getting better and not worse.
Well, then it begs the question, well, why don't they then?
Well, we haven't asked them yet, have we? We haven't brought in this legislation, so we're waiting on the government to do it. So I'm waiting with bated breath. I really hope that we're now going to see some real, you know, vision from this government because, you know, really, we have everything that, you know, available to make Britain succeed. We just need the investment. And we need to be ensuring that all of those people who are going out there working really hard, that we are supporting them. We're supporting them and we're providing them with the backing that they need. Look at, you know, all those people that are holding up our NHS and are struggling and are saying that actually we need better investment. Our pensioners who've worked so hard that we're able to look after them. And knowing that the money is there and we're not asking for it, it just doesn't make sense. Like I said, we've got to look at how money has just been concentrating into the hands of fewer and fewer people and what the impact of that has been for the rest of British people. We shouldn't be accepting that. We should be asking those with the most money to contribute more because they can.
And I support what you're saying, and I think that the organisation Patriotic Millionaires UK, which you represent, you co-founded it, is a positive thing. But is it possible that, in the absence of those rich individuals being asked, they could say that they're for it. It's a sort of reputation washing. But when it comes down to it, then they might not be so keen.
Well, we need to find out, because we keep, you know, coming up with these arguments as, you know, what might happen. I think we need to see what will happen. We need to take this brave step and just this, you know, this common sense step that, yeah, you can't keep pushing small to medium sized businesses and people who are working and already struggling to feed their families. You can't keep pushing them and not just asking for a reasonable contribution from people who absolutely can provide it without it making any difference to their lifestyles whatsoever. And you know what? You know, it's better for everybody. I don't believe it's good for anyone, no matter how much money you've got, to live in a society where things have become so unequal that, you know, that you're then concerned about, you know, your kids going out at night because you're worried about, you know, safety, because we haven't continued to properly fund our criminal justice system. And it's better for everyone. If you're running a business, you want a well-educated, healthy workforce. You can only have that if you invest in it. And you can only, you know, continue to invest at the levels we need if we ask for investment or require investment from where the money is.
Very good to talk to you, Julia. Thanks very much for that. Julia Davis, co-founder of Patriotic Millionaires UK, a group of wealthy individuals calling for the tax burden to be directed towards those with the wealth. So what do you make of that? The other side of this, part of this story, is that a cabinet minister dropped a heavy hint today that Labour is on the verge of axing the two-child benefit cap. So there's two opposite ends to this story. What do you think about the idea to increase the two-child benefit cap? I mean, is it a good idea, or is it just encouraging people to have more children that they can't afford? And what of the idea of taxing the wealthy more? I mean, £10 million does seem like, or taxing the wealth of those who have more than £10 million, That does seem to be a bit of an ask, because there's a considerable number of people who are, at least on paper, millionaires. 3 million, I think, people in this country have assets of £1 million or more. Surely we could start a little bit lower than 10 million. Or, as is always threatened, will they just up sticks and go? 0345... 6060973. You can text 84850, email nick@lbc.co.uk. And if you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973.
LBC. Julie could part exchange her car or check out We Buy Any Car. She could be unsure if she got a good deal part exchanging, or have cash in the bank with more bargaining power to get a bigger car for her five-a-side team. Totally played. Or total player. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Calling all little wildlife explorers. Playmobil is now in Happy Meal. Look, is that a seal? And a sea turtle? They've been around for millions of years, just like me. Which will your little ones discover? Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 14th of October, from 11 a.m, Playmobil comprised toys only, subject to availability.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
This Labour government, just like the Conservative governments before it, seemed to be somewhat reluctant to challenge the wealthiest among us to pay more tax. I mean, they're sort of baby steps, taking putting VAT on private education, I suppose, was a positive move forwards. But generally, the super rich seem to get a pass. And the notion is that if we are in trouble as a country, which we most certainly are, then those who have the most should be able to contribute the most. But am I not right in thinking that the more that people appear to get, the more urgent is their need to keep more of it? I mean, I suppose the greed motive is what might get you wealthy in the first place, and would then colour your notions of giving some of it up in tax. 0345 6060 973. Leytonstone. Hello, Robert.
Good evening. I've got a few points on this one, actually, and I have to say I do disagree. Now, if you remember, which I think you might do, back in the 70s, Labour did something similar in starting to raise very high taxes on those with a lot of money, wealthy ones, and they left the country. And they didn't come back for a very long time, not until Brexit came about for some of them. I think some of them actually came back then. Now,
They left in the 1970s and came back after Brexit. I'm not sure about that, Robert. But you're well, right. People did complain. Beatles wrote a song about it. 19 for you and one for me, I think, was the line. But that's not the kind of tax that we're talking about here.
I know it isn't, yeah. And if you remember, there was reports on LBC about the fact that the discussion of the 50s and the 70s and people leaving and actually coming back then at Brexit time. Like the film industry, there was lots of people there that actually looked at coming back to the UK. So
after Brexit, it's been discussed. Well, let's not get bogged down in that. I don't think you're right there, but anyway, go on.
Yeah, okay. So the idea that we should gamble, because if people do leave and, you know, they're not going to come back for a long time, probably. Even if the Conservatives got back in, they probably wouldn't come back again.
All right. Now, so who
there's
is
an
to...
alternative? Okay. We lose out billions for years.
Right. Okay.
On that.
But who's going to pay the tax then that is needed to prop up the NHS, to put police on the streets, to get the potholes fixed, and all of the rest of the stuff that people rely on?
Right. Let me just point out another one on the tax. Right. If they go non-dom, then those people that have lots of millions and billions even overseas, under her sort of thing of doing and taxing on that, if they then consider that that money becomes taxable in the UK because of the non-dom removal status, then people who've got billions overseas are not going to pay that tax in the UK.
Right, okay. All right, so we've established that you don't think that the rich will stand for paying more tax. So then that means you will be paying more tax.
I can overcome that issue, okay? Now, there's another thing, as I said to you, some people only have to adjust a couple of weeks in the UK and then they can avoid tax in the UK. So that's another one. There's lots of reasons.
Okay, well, you've given us a lot of reasons why the rich won't pay. Yes, yes, what's the alternative?
The alternative, right, is I think that we've got to do it. I don't think we actually got a choice on this, actually. So now then. And let me explain, after I've told you what it is, let me explain how we can avoid paying for those that you will initially think will lose out by what I'm going to propose. And what I propose is that we cut the NHS bill by something like 20 billion. Now, so it's about, if you look at the...
I don't know what the NHS bill is. Is it 100 billion, something like that? So you're 20%.
I think it's on the way to 200
is it?
Billion.
All right,
now.
Well, let's say 10%. Okay, how are we going to do that?
So, right, now, if we do that and cut that, that saves a lot of money, and I think that will bring down probably the cost to the government on interest rates for the money it's borrowing, because people will see that the government is actually addressing the overspending.
But how are we going to knock 10% off the NHS bill?
Right. Okay. Now then, there's things that the NHS are doing that the public, I think, those with money in particular, would be prepared to pay for, okay? So, for example, if we were to remove from the NHS the, fertilisation of women, and also, like, mental health, because mental health is a kind of like a society issue as opposed to an NHS issue, I look on it.
Why is your mental health a society issue rather than a medical one?
Because it's the environment that you're in your community that is probably putting you into that stressful situation, okay?
I think that severely misunderstands the concept of mental health, but anyway, go on.
Yeah, there are people who it falls into, I think, that it is that the society that they're in, the communities that they're living in, and the work environment, and it is a society issue, a lot of it. Now then, if you have charities and organisations, and if we do what Keir Starmer said and suggested earlier on, that we create, say, in towns and high streets and that, a kind of community centre where people can go and discuss things and get help on things and so forth, I think people will give money to charities, and those charities would then look at helping people with mental issues,
right.
Helping people with
mental issues. Okay, so can I nutshell your argument? You're saying that we should spend less on the NHS in the expectation that rich people will be generous enough to give to charities the money that they would then use to fill in the gaps of the decimated NHS under your plan.
Well, if you look at, like, last Friday, was it? You were raising money, weren't you, LBC?
So we're relying on the kindness of strangers.
You're depending on your community and society, yes. And that we have to do. And remember this. If people didn't pay for the NHS through taxation, but actually gave their money sort of directly to the bills of the NHS, then by cutting out government and local authorities and things like that, we can save billions
a
year.
Well, that's an interesting take, because we don't have to guess what would happen, because we can see what happens in America. And, of course, if you pay an insurance company for your to be medically treated, then the insurance company has to take a cut, and the Americans spend more per head of population on health than any other country in the world. So I'm not sure your sums exactly add up there, Robert, but it's an interesting take. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. More of your calls on this to come. And just after the news, ahead of the release of the Israeli hostages, we'll cross live to Tel Aviv to speak with a peace activist. First, at just after 10:30, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
President Trump is now flying to Egypt ahead of talks on his peace plan for the Middle East. The multinational gathering is due to be held at Sharm el-Sheikh and will also include the Secretary-General of the United Nations. Kemi Badenoch's written to the Prime Minister demanding answers in Parliament over the collapse of a court case against alleged Chinese spies. The Tory leader is calling for senior ministers to address the comments about what happened before the charges were dropped. And France's newly reappointed Prime Minister has named a new government. Sébastien Lecornu is facing pressure to urgently produce a budget and limit political instability. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in the west. Cloudier for eastern areas with patchy fog across England and Scotland. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees.
This is LBC.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of. Where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts. And where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
Welcome on board this LNER service from London King's Cross to Edinburgh. My name's Paul, your train manager today, and hang on, is that a Scrabble tournament in coach here? Yes, G with an X is a word. Right, we're cruising at 125 miles per hour, same speed this lad next to me is typing. Someone's on a roll! The cafe bar's in coach G if you fancy a brew, or if you're mid-box set binge, just order through the QR code at your seat. We'll deliver it. So sit back and enjoy your journey. With LNER, it's freedom all the way.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
More of your thoughts on taxing the rich to come and what you think of the idea to lift the two-child benefit cap. But let's talk about what's happening in Gaza at the moment. Israel expects all living hostages to be released by Hamas early tomorrow morning. Let's cross to Tel Aviv, where Danielle Bett, a British-Israeli peace activist and political analyst, is on the phone. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. So what's the latest from there, then?
Well, at the moment, everyone's waiting anxiously to see the hostages actually being released and returned to their families. It's supposed to be 8 a.m. Israel time. Trump has said it might be sooner, so we're just kind of waiting very anxiously, hoping that they actually do return and that this peace deal or ceasefire does go through.
And what do we know of the thousands of Palestinian prisoners whose release is part of the deal?
I mean, obviously, some will be concerned. There are security concerns with some. Others have been held in prison for various reasons. So obviously very complicated with the way in which the prison system for Palestinians works in Israel. But it's, yeah, there are some concerns about it. But the important thing is that Israel should be able to keep Israelis secure, which they weren't able to on October 7th, obviously. And so that will follow the hostage release. And from there, we have to manage the security issues.
So that's the timing of it. Is it the Israeli hostages are to be released tomorrow, after which I think it's 1,700 Palestinians taken since the war started, some held without charge. They are to be released afterwards.
That's correct, and that includes minors. I don't know the exact timing of when they'll be released, but yes.
So what kind of a place are Palestinians now returning to, given that the ceasefire is still holding?
I mean, Palestinians living in Gaza, obviously, I'm sure you've seen images of Gaza. It's an absolute destruction. And so to think of rebuilding, it's going to be a very, very long process. Some of the people I've spoken to who have relatives in Gaza, I think, are just relieved to be able to hopefully soon access more food and not be under constant bombardment. And so obviously it's not a huge celebration, but also some relief. And hopefully the international community helps in rebuilding Gaza.
What of that food issue? Because aid agencies say that 600 lorries of aid are needed to go into Gaza every day. Do we know how many are actually entering or whether their stocks will be able to be replenished once they do?
I don't know how many have been agreed in the proposal, and it's also a question of how it's managed by Israel and the Palestinian Authority and the U.S., but there are huge amounts of aid that are supposed to be going through. It's not just food, it's also medical assistance and, you know, even shelter. So there's a lot that needs to go in to allow Palestinians to have, you know, a decent, very basic decency in life.
And so what we're witnessing and anticipating at the moment is the first stage of this peace plan, isn't it? The hostage swap is the first, probably the easiest part of the deal. The next is the withdrawal of Israeli troops. Isn't that dependent on Hamas relinquishing its weapons? And I believe that they're reluctant to do that unilaterally.
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't say the hostage release is easy until it's done, but I think that there's not a full withdrawal of the IDF planned yet. They're still very much planning on staying in parts of the strip. And so we'll have to see how that's managed. Of course, the most important thing is to secure the return of the hostages and ensure that Gazans have aid and that the ceasefire holds. But we have to think more long-term how we're actually going to manage rebuilding the Gaza Strip, ensuring Israel's security, and managing in a way that doesn't involve Hamas. And that means that a different political alternative for Palestinians needs to be offered. So we'll have to work with, for example, the Palestinian Authority.
Do you think that there's shortly to be a different political makeup to the government in Israel? I mean, is Netanyahu going to be able to survive this?
I never say never with Netanyahu. He's been able to survive many, many elections and build various coalitions. Overall, he's not been polling well. But I hope that this movement of protests and people who have, I mean, I'm sure you heard the booing against him at Hostage Square last night. The public is very frustrated. And so hopefully that does show in the elections. But it depends also on the various other political parties that run and what platform they run on.
And what about this interim government idea to be created? Do you or the Israelis have much confidence in the success of that?
In the interim government in Gaza?
Yes.
Listen, I think the most important thing that's lacking is engagement with Palestinians on this issue. I don't know that Israelis are thinking that far. I do think more trust, they have more trust in the international community and especially the U.S. than they do in our government on these issues. And so I think international involvement is crucial. But we have to talk to Palestinians. We can't have an interim government or change in Gaza or anywhere in the West Bank without involving Palestinians in decision-making.
Now, the final phase of the peace plan is for a recognition of Palestinian statehood. But, you know, the Israeli Prime Minister is famously against that. What do you think of the prospects of that?
Under this current government, they're completely against it, and we're on the route to a one-state solution because they also want to annex the West Bank, and they've talked about settling in Gaza, which, again, it seems the U.S. and the international community have put their foot down against that. But, yeah, this has to be the start of putting the two-state solution back on the table and being serious about these negotiations and being clear that it's not acceptable. Palestinians aren't going anywhere. Israelis are not going anywhere. And so we have to both be able to live in sovereignty and security.
Well, fingers crossed. Things are better today than they have been up to this point. Danielle, thanks so much for your time. That's Danielle Bett, British-Israeli peace activist, political analyst based in Tel Aviv. She's also director of communications at Yachad, a British-Jewish organization promoting a political resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Right, let's talk more about money, shall we? 0345-6060-973. Cabinet Minister dropped a hint today that Labour is on the verge of axing the two-child benefit cap. I wonder what you think of that. And I was talking to Julia Davis before, the co-founder of Patriotic Millionaires UK, about the prospect of taxing the rich. The idea of that organisation is to tax at 2% the wealth above £10 million of the richest among us. And we are constantly told by those who lobby on behalf of the rich that any such thing would be completely impossible because they'd up sticks and leave. What do you make of that? 0345-6060-973. Golders Green. Hello, John.
Hi, good evening. It's difficult to start, really, because in very round figures, the UK approximately affects...
Oh, it's a very, very bad line, John. We'll call you back. All right.
Hello?
Exactly. We'll call you back. Try and call John back. In the meantime, let's talk to Ealing. Hello, Moses.
Hi. Have a good evening. In my opinion, I think the rich people should pay a tax. I don't know if you remember some years ago they were telling us we need the bankers, and then if you let the banker go, you know, the country would be in trouble. And then the banker went down, and then we had a recession. I think it was 2008. Yes. So I think the rich people should pay a tax, and those people who they want to leave, they should leave. I mean, whoever makes money in this country, no matter where they're from, they should pay a tax. I remember some years ago, not long years ago, there were a coffee company who they never pay a tax. I don't want to name them. You know, they make money in this country and they say we cannot pay a tax. And the government should take the business of offshore. Just whoever lives here, they pay a tax. As simple as that. And whoever makes money here, they should pay a tax.
Yes, a tax. But the wealthy would normally complain if they have to pay anything more, well, certainly, than they are paying at the moment. They would claim that, well, I'm already paying a lot of income tax, and they make not much noise about where their real wealth is, which is their assets.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they don't like it, they can leave. Just tell them that you leave and see what's happened. This is the nonsense. Unfortunately, in Western country, the government doesn't govern the country. The rich people are governing the country, not the government. They dictate the government how to govern the country. That's why they always are winning. That's why within that recession, within that 5 years' time, which we had the COVID, the number of millionaire and billionaire went up.
It's increased dramatically, yes. The wealth of the super rich has skyrocketed since COVID. Yes, no doubt about that. And everybody else has flatlined, not just since COVID, but since about the 1970s. the value in the of the wealth of the super rich has gone up like a rocket since the 70s, and everybody else is just pedaling furiously to stay in the same place. All right, good talking to you, Moses. Thanks for that. Alan in Reigate says, patriotic millionaires tell it as it is. Great to hear Julia on with you, and she is correct. Gold is green. Let's see if this line works. Hello, John.
Any better?
I think so.
Okay, too. I started by saying that the UK raises approximately $1,000 billion or £1 trillion in taxes every year. But unfortunately, all this talk about this lady that was on before, it's all raising tuppence halfpenny, because 60% of that money, $600 billion, is raised from income tax, national insurance, and VAT, which are the very issues that Labour has promised not to touch. And if you start messing with all this other stuff, it makes very little difference. This lady, very well-meaning, I've done the figures. If we actually manage to enact what she says, we're going to raise precisely £1 billion. Okay? And that has to be set in the context of inheritance tax, which raises just under £8 billion at the moment. It's actually really small beer compared to the really big stuff. I happen to be in favour of a wealth tax, but only if and only if you actually abolish the inheritance tax. Because I believe if you abolish the inheritance tax, you could actually sell the British people on a small wealth tax that they pay during the course of their lives over, say, 50 years, and it would raise much, much more than the £7 billion a year, multiples more, because it would be much harder to avoid, and it would be easy to pay, and people would understand it. And then when you lose a loved one, you don't have to mess around with probate. Everything is just all paid off, free and clear, and it goes to your descendants.
So you're talking about an extra tax on top of income tax?
I'm talking about abolishing inheritance tax.
Yeah, I understand that bit.
And replacing it with a small wealth tax that you would pay over, say, 50 years. Not for everybody.
Yes, but based on what? A tax based on what, though?
Sorry?
Would it be a flat tax on everybody, or a tax based on your income, or
no,
or
Nick,
what?
I just said it would be a tax based on people who have wealth above a certain amount.
No, but that doesn't make sense, because you go through life, you can't pay tax on the wealth that you might accrue in the future.
No, every year when you fill out your tax return, you make a list of your net assets, and if they're above a certain threshold, you pay this wealth tax. And you pay it over 50 years. So in year one, you pay a certain tax. In year two, if you've gone up, you pay a bit more tax. And if you've gone down, you pay less tax.
Right, so it's a kind of a combination between capital gains tax and an income tax.
Well, you might want to say it like that. But the point is, over 50 years, right, you're going to actually end up paying a lot less than the 40% inheritance tax. But because everybody will pay it, as opposed to the 4% of people who actually pay inheritance tax, you're going to raise a lot more than £7 or £8 billion, and very comfortably and easily. You're going to raise £40, £50, £60 billion that way.
Right, well, it sounds like you're just making numbers up out of the air. Well, you could say that you've done the figures, but you haven't presented them to us. You just magic numbers out of the air, and you said 40, 50, 60 billion. I mean, which is it? Well, it's an interesting idea, but it does sound like extra income tax to me. And I'm not sure, well, first of all, it's the one thing that, or one of the things that the Labour government said that they weren't going to do. And I don't think that really that's the kind of thing that people would support. At the end of your life, perhaps, that makes more sense to have some sort of inheritance tax. But as you are accruing your wealth, I mean, surely the idea of a business person, for instance, accruing wealth, the most positive thing for them to do would be to reinvest it in their business, which would then create even more wealth in the future. But if you just sort of dribble, if you just like drain it out of people on a slow basis through their life, that sounds like it would have more problems that it caused than it's solved. But an interesting idea, John. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Unflinching.
I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning.
Unyielding.
No. No. No.
And at times, for many, uncomfortable.
What a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer.
Tomorrow marks 100 years since the birth of Margaret Thatcher. In a special show, we'll assess the legacy of the Iron Lady.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
At Pension Bee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionbee.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back, and with a 1 in 4 chance to win instantly on pack, you could get your hands on a £2,000 Jet 2 holiday, a Big Mac, Merlin annual passes for 4, and even more epic prizes. Go on, it's your go. 18 plus, UK, ends 21st of October. Selected menu items, subject to availability. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Are you a London black cab driver thinking of ways to boost your earnings during those quieter times? Why not consider Uber? We can give your meter a wake-up call. Join close to 1,000 black cab drivers already on Uber. Black cabs on Uber are priced by your meter, and the service fee will be no more than 5% until the end of 2025. Turn downtime into prime time. Go to uber.com/blackcabs to start earning today. Terms and conditions apply.
Someone in the UK has got that Euro Millions feeling because they have won the incredible £26 million Euro Millions jackpot. I reckon they've had a bit of a dance. All around the house, then out the door, down the path and into the street. For all we know, they're probably still dancing. Go on, guys. Get that Euro Millions feeling. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We are talking about the potential for tax on the rich in the forthcoming budget. That is... the suggestion has been dropped many times now and has been received with outrage from the usual sources. What do you make of the idea? JP says, so people who bought a house many years ago will now be taxed on their wealth according to the inflated amount it's now worth. Great idea, pricing regular folks out so that the same parasites can scoop it up as usual. I don't know who those parasites are that you're referring to, JP. But as an idea, that doesn't seem to be too bad to me. I mean, if you... say in the 1960s, bought a house for £20,000 in a grotty place called Notting Hill, and fast forward to today, and it's worth £5 million, well, you haven't done anything to increase the value of that asset other than just sit there and watch it happen. Meanwhile, around you has been provided better security, better roads, better lighting, a redevelopment of the area, better health service, keeping all of the people that make that happen healthier. And you haven't contributed a bean to that, but your house has gone up because of it. So why shouldn't you be taxed on it? Bristol. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. I've got a different perspective on this. Don't tax the rich. Tax people on benefits.
Tax people on benefits. I thought benefits were subject to tax.
They're not.
They are.
Now... well, I'm on benefits. I'm not being taxed.
Well, pensions are a benefit. Pensions are taxed, surely?
Oh yes. Okay. Yeah. But leave those poor pensioners alone. think about it. On benefits, you can earn up to £23,000.
Right.
Personal tax allowance is 12,750, I think.
Mm.
So why don't they pay tax on the difference?
Well, why not just give them less? Cut out the middleman.
I know, but hang on a minute. That's what causes the Labour Party to go up in arms when you say, oh, we're going to tax benefits. I mean, we're going to cut benefits. The social contract is, we won't cut your benefits, just pay tax on it. Why does my mum, who is a pensioner, pay tax on her pension... and people on benefits don't. What's the difference?
Well, it's an interesting thought. Let's not tax the rich. Let's tax the poor.
No.
Well, yes, that's exactly what you just said.
Whatever you're going to do. No, I did say that. But what I'm trying to say is that there is. I'll give you my personal perspective. You name the disease, I have it. Let's test this one out.
I'm not going to name a disease. No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Fine. But I have it. So I think I'm perfectly entitled to be on benefits, but it doesn't stop me trying to improve my life. I am applying for jobs left, right and centre. I used to work in publishing. Hmm.
Are you being sarcastic when you say that you think that the answer to our financial problems is to tax the poor?
No, it's not. I'm not being sarcastic, but there's a possible... I'm scared every single day of my life when I hear all these stories about we're going to slash benefits. I'd rather say, okay, fine, take 10% of it.
Right. Well, I think that would constitute slashing. But it's an interesting thought. We're chock full of interesting thoughts in this hour. Thanks for that, Jenny. Archie in Inverness says, Nick, where the rich are concerned, the more they get, the more they want. Given they can buy both influence and power, I can't see Starmer changing his reform light spots. Well, there does seem to be evidence that the more the rich get, the more determined they are to keep every single solitary last penny of it. I mean, it's probably got something to do with the mindset of the person that would enable somebody to become rich in the first place. I mean, a lack of empathy for others... an advanced sense of greed, that kind of thing. And so if that helps you to become rich, then you don't suddenly become philanthropic when you reach a state of richness. You're the same person, and then that explains why the super rich avail themselves of giant shiny buildings of accounting and legal experts in order to make their money disappear. And that's what we do for a living in this country. And as I said to Julia earlier on, if you look at the top 10 tax havens in the world, I think it's either 6 or 7 of them are associated with this country. It's how we make our living. Well, it's how a lot of people make their living. Bristol, Tiago.
Hi, Nick. How's it going?
Good, thanks.
Did I just hear a fellow Bristolian say that we should be squeezing people benefits further? I'm still a bit shocked over that.
It's an idea I haven't heard before, but, you know, we live and learn.
I mean, I guess the room should be open for ideas, right?
Yes.
I really like what I forgot her name, but you mentioned the founder of the
Julia.
Group of millionaires, yeah. Yes, who believe that wealth should be taxed 2% over 10 million, which, you know, that's just like common sense housekeeping. Once someone crosses a certain threshold of wealth, I mean, they have enough money for all their basic needs. And, you know, infrastructure costs money. We can't expect to continue to offer, you know, the UK experience they so love, you know, the courts, the good schools, mm-hmm. and everything else without contributing more. Every time the budget's about to come out, it's like pantomime. Oh my God, the millionaires are living. Oh, shock horror. I just always wonder how many of those are actually wealth creators rather than people just, you know, speculating in stock shortening and whatever else
yes.
they do with money that we don't even know if it exists. You know, like it's just like numbers on a screen.
Well, there doesn't seem to be any limits to their avarice. And as an example of this, I often look at the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. This is an index of how the richest people in not just in this country but in the world are doing financially on a day-to-day basis. And the world's richest human yesterday. Well, it's Sunday now, so we're probably talking about Friday. On Friday alone, made £4,000,000,000.
I mean, sometimes I worry coming across as some sort of incurable lefty, but you know, it's such a sad reality that we have enough wealth and resources in this world to, you know, end all hunger and all the problems. So if that's too idealistic, can we not at least expect that people just contribute a bit more
I mean, we're not talking about people who are super rich having all of their money taken away. We're talking about an amount that wouldn't affect their lifestyles at all. You could take 99% of Elon Musk's money away, and it wouldn't affect his ability to fund his lifestyle one bit. As an example. Thanks, Tiago. Thanks very much for all of that. We're going to move on after the news. Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson says that Jewish students do not feel safe as she calls on universities to crack down on discrimination. University staff and students will receive training at universities to tackle anti-Semitism. Is there a problem with anti-Semitism at university? Have you or somebody you know experienced prejudice on campus? And if so, what needs to change to make university a safer place? 0345 6060 973 Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. President Trump has begun his journey to Egypt ahead of tomorrow's multinational talks on his peace plan for the Middle East. It's expected he'll attend the event in Sharm el-Sheikh and also address the Israeli parliaments during his time in the region. He spoke to reporters moments before boarding Air Force One.
This is a very special event. They had 500,000 people yesterday and today in Israel, and also the Muslim and Arab countries are all cheering. Everybody's cheering at one time. That's never happened before.
Israel has confirmed no Palestinian prisoners will be released as part of the Washington peace deal until all of its hostages have been returned by Hamas. It's believed the 20 living captives will be freed as a group tomorrow morning. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has given a speech this evening calling for a new Israeli unity.
I know that many controversies amongst us, but on this day, and hopefully in the near future, we've got every reason under the sun to put them to one side on the back burner. We have achieved so much amazing victories that amaze the entire world.
A woman is being held by police investigating the deaths of two children in Staffordshire. She's due to be questioned on the suspicion of murder after the pair were found in Stafford this morning. There are new suggestions Prince Andrew was contacting the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein for much longer than he'd previously claimed. A new email has been published appearing to show the Duke of York telling the disgraced financier, "We're in this together." Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing, but the former Home Office Minister, Norman Baker, has been telling LBC the King can't remain silent for much longer.
I think he has to make a public statement because that's a last resort. I mean, I think he has to protect the monarchy, which no doubt he wants to do, by saying, you know, this is not how the monarchy operates, and I don't accept that this behaviour is acceptable. He has to say that, I think, at this point now. There's nothing else to be done.
And President Zelensky says a Ukrainian counter-offensive has made gains against Russia in the Zaporizhia region. He's been using his nightly video address to say Kyiv's troops have advanced 3 kilometres. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in the west overnight. Cloudier for eastern areas with patchy fog across England and Scotland. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Bridget Phillipson has written to vice-chancellors urging them to take what she calls practical and proportionate steps to protect Jewish students as part of government efforts to stamp out anti-Semitism following the Manchester terror attack. 600 training sessions are going to be offered to university staff over the coming weeks to help them, this is a quote, identify harassment and hate and facilitate open, respectful debate. That's according to the Department of Education. Well, let's talk about this with Lewis Danker. Lewis is president of the Union of Jewish Students and joins us on the line. Hello, Lewis.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks. Is there a widespread problem of anti-Semitism on university campuses?
There absolutely is. We've seen 2 years of record high levels of anti-Semitism on campus, ranging from microaggressions to physical assault. In the year after the October 7th attacks in 2023, there was a 413% rise in campus anti-Semitism. That's according to the Community Security Trust. What we see is Jewish students in Britain being blamed for the actions of a government thousands of miles away. And particularly in the past week, we've seen rampant glorification of terrorism and of Hamas on campus as well.
Well, those protests, do you think that a pro-Palestine protest is anti-Jewish or anti the Israeli government? They're not the same, are they?
No, they're not. And many pro-Palestine protests pass entirely peacefully and without incident. We absolutely respect the right to protest. This isn't about banning activism. This is very much about the manner of protest. I'll give you some examples from this week. So we saw one student group talk about their beloved resistance carrying out the glorious Al-Aqsa flood, which is Hamas's own code name for the October 7th attack. We saw a student shout to put the Zios in the ground. Now, Zio is a slur for Jewish people coined by David Duke, who was the Grand Wizard of the KKK. And there was a student on LBC who was in a protest who said that Jewish students' feelings about the protest simply weren't valid. So what we're seeing isn't legitimate pro-Palestinian activism in many cases. It's actually quite anti-Semitic and very much glorifies terrorism.
Isn't it a bit like, though, trying to tackle bias, trying to tackle distrust? It'll always be there, won't it? It's human nature.
I think education's really important. So, you know, we really welcome the fact that the Department for Education are supporting the Union of Jewish Students' Anti-Semitism Awareness Training for university staff. There's a real great deal of ignorance on campus, and I think that spreading education far and wide to university leaders, to student union staff, to campus security, student welfare officers, it's a really important first step and one that's been coming for some time. I think the next step is giving clear directives from DfE to universities about the action that they should be taking to enforce their own codes of conduct.
Right. Now, it seems to me that much of this is coming from social media. Do you think that perhaps the universities are being unfairly targeted here? It should actually, any action by the government should actually be directed at the source of the problem, which is social media.
I think both of those things can be true at the same time. I think that we need to see action on social media. We need to see organisations like Meta taking a firmer stance against the glorification of terror and of hate on their platforms. But, you know, we've launched our Stand Against Terror campaign at the Union of Jewish Students this week. And that is saying to vice chancellors and student union presidents, actually, we need you to have a zero tolerance policy against the glorification of Hamas. It is not legal in the United Kingdom to support a proscribed terrorist organization. Now, vice chancellors need to take a firm stance against terror and discipline those who are responsible for this.
Do you think it's a bit specific, though? I mean, the proposals are to eradicate anti-Semitism on campus. I mean, that is valid. But if campus cohesion is the goal, shouldn't the plan be more all-encompassing to tackle, for instance, racism in general, misogyny, homophobia, so on?
Absolutely. And I think many of those programs are underway. I think what we've seen in the past 2 years is that often campus and student politics as a whole has a little bit of a blind spot when it comes to anti-Semitism, whereby... So the student movement is very good at calling out racism and misogyny within its ranks, but appears to let anti-Semitism slide. It is quite uncommon for a form of discrimination to be more frequent now than it was, say, 10 years ago. But that's been the case with anti-Semitism on campus. And so I think there needs to be a bit of singularity when it comes to calling out anti-Semitism and tackling it from the ground upwards through training.
Well, what about anti-Muslim actions?
Absolutely agree. I mean, the horrendous attack on the Peacehaven Mosque a couple of weeks ago was a real wake-up call for everyone. And I think many of these things can be dealt with in tandem. I think we really risk, you know, when violent language breeds violent acts, we really need to cool the temperature, dial down the temperature on campus and in society as a whole. And I think education and training is really important. Interfaith work is really important. I know Jewish students across the country that I work with every day are really keen to build bridges with their Muslim colleagues and others. So we really need to start addressing hate wherever we find it.
is it possible that this is being somewhat overblown? Because right enough, there's a 117% rise in anti-Semitic incidents on university campuses, but that accounts for 272 incidents. That the percentage rise is large, but the actual number of incidents is quite small because it's less than one incident per college or university per year.
I think at this stage it's worth reminding ourselves that Jewish people are less than 0.5% of the population of this country. And there have been reports in the past week saying that the vast majority of religious hate crime is targeted against Jewish people per capita. And so I think looking at, you know, numbers is one way of approaching it, but looking at percentages is another. I think it's also worth saying there is quite significant underreporting of anti-Semitism on campus. We at the Union of Jewish Students and at the Community Security Trust have seen that reporting numbers have fallen as campus anti-Semitism has become more normalized. So Jewish students are seeing things like put the Zios in the ground or glory to the Intifada, and they aren't reporting it because they've become so used to it. This stuff is prevalent. I think if you ask any Jewish student or any student, frankly, who's got their eyes open to it, they see it on campus all the time.
But would you accept that that's also the case for gay students, trans students, Muslim students, anybody that really is different in any way?
Absolutely. And I think we need to be trying incredibly hard to stamp out discrimination of all forms. The constituents I represent are Jewish students. I think they're reeling after the attack in Manchester a week and a half ago. We've seen the real threat of anti-Semitism in this country rise yet again. And so I think I really welcome the fact that the government is taking a really strong approach to rooting out anti-Semitism where it festers. And in the past years, that has been on campus.
Is there any part of you that is concerned, perhaps, at the direction that the country is moving in? The government policy of restricting protests, of limiting the number of protests a group is allowed, that's part of the directive to universities, is similar to that being proposed for protests in the country more generally, a sort of Trumpian move to crack down on protests that the government doesn't like?
Look, Nick, I'm here to talk about Jewish students on campus, and I'm pretty clear that we respect the right to protest and we don't want to ban activism. We want universities to consider the time, the place, and the manner of protests. The protest I'm concerned about happened on the anniversary of October the 7th in the centre of campus, many of which blocked libraries and lecture theatres, and they endorsed proscribed terrorist organisations. I think people talking about the right to protest are having the wrong debate at the moment. I'm talking about the right to glorify terrorism, and I absolutely don't think that right exists.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up the date, because the Prime Minister himself said that a protest on a certain day, i.e. the pro-Palestine protest on the anniversary of October the 7th, he described it as un-British. Does that not ring alarm bells, that now we're saying that a protest is unpatriotic if it doesn't meet the government's approval?
Listen, I'm not interested in talking about whether something is un-British or unpatriotic. I'm interested in talking about whether something is unlawful. And what we're seeing here is support for proscribed terrorist organisations. It's against the law, and we need to see a crackdown on it.
But do you think that the universities should be sort of at the crosshairs here? I mean, it just because it happens on university campus doesn't make it their fault.
It has always been thus that campus magnifies trends in society as a whole, and on campus we see often more extreme versions of patterns that are emerging in wider society. So, you know, I work for the Union of Jewish Students. I very much care about campus being a place where Jewish students can be safe and partake in their education like any student. So I absolutely think we need to think about campus. Campus is where people garner an education to go on to the rest of their lives. And we need to make sure that those spaces are not only safe for Jewish people, but can provide an education to student leaders about what anti-Semitism is and how you can root it out.
The government says that this scheme will be funded to the tune of £7 million. That seems like a small amount. Is it doing something, or is it more to be seen to be doing something?
It's my experience having, you know, the Union of Jewish Students has delivered anti-Semitism awareness training for many years, and it's our experience that it has a real impact. You can get to change makers, people who make decisions in institutions, many of whom will have met very few Jews in their life before and won't have sort of encountered anti-Semitism in their daily life. And to present them with the lived experience of students on their campus and give them practical, tangible steps they can take to improve life for Jewish students on campus, that's incredibly powerful and has a real impact that filters down to the wider sort of student community.
All right, good to talk to you, Lewis. Thanks for that. Lewis Danker, president of the Union of Jewish Students. So what do you make of this plan then? Bridget Phillipson, education secretary, has written to vice chancellors urging them to take what she calls practical and proportionate steps to protect Jewish students as part of government efforts to stamp out anti-Semitism. Is it such a problem on university and college campuses that the government needs to intervene to this extent? And do you find it a bit odd that they aren't mentioning other, perhaps what you might call hate crimes, to those who are gay and Muslim and trans and so on? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nick@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345 6060 973.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why this staggering level of incompetence?
Straight to the point.
This is the economics of the madhouse from this government.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
But she does seem to struggle with her sums.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet. She's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Yes, we're talking about what's described as an increase in incidents of anti-Jewish speech and protest and attacks on university campuses. Now, Bridget Phillipson has written to vice-chancellors, as I said, urging them to take whatever steps are appropriate to protect Jewish students as part of government efforts to stamp out anti-Semitism. 600 training sessions are going to be offered to university staff over the coming weeks to help them identify harassment and hate. Does somebody who runs a university really need to have a training session to identify harassment and hate? The rest of it is to facilitate open, respectful debate. That's what the Department of Education says. It sort of sounds a bit like what Donald Trump is doing in America. Thousands of teachers would be trained to teach young people how to challenge misinformation online. And this plan is to be funded to the tune of £7 million, which is not, in the scheme of things, a great deal of money, but it does amount to about £23,000 per higher education establishment, if there's just under 300 universities and colleges in the land. Is that £23,000 well spent? Universities must manage protests in a way that allows all students to fully participate in campus life, which could involve moving repeated demonstrations that are intrusive or disruptive, the Department for Education said. Should that be down to the universities, or is that more of a policing job? It follows a warning from the Higher Education Watchdog that universities could face action if Jewish students are not protected from harassment, after several institutions saw pro-Palestine protests earlier this week. Well, as we've just established, a pro-Palestine protest is not an anti-Jewish protest. If anything, it's an anti-Israeli government protest, which is a completely different thing, surely. But what would action mean? That really does sound like something that Trump would say. The Higher Education Watchdogs said that universities could face action if Jewish students are not protected from harassment. Now, how would a university be able to do that? Because harassment can come in many forms. It can come from somebody saying something stupid as they just pass you on the way to the lecture theatre. And but the threat of action, if something is not done, it rings alarm bells with me. How about you? Protesters said it was necessary... Oh, hang on. Protesters said it was necessary to demonstrate to bring attention to the suffering in Gaza, which is surely what most of the protesters were doing. They weren't protesting against Jewish people. They were protesting against the plight of the people in Gaza. Or am I getting that wrong? 67,000 Palestinians have been killed in the war so far. That's according to the enclave's health ministry, which is part of the Hamas-run government, does not distinguish between civilians and combatants. Keir Starmer said that the timing of the protest was un-British, which is also something that Donald Trump might say. So what do you make of this? 0345-6060-973. Vancouver. Hello, Nick.
Oh, hi, Nick. Yeah, I think back to my days in the 1980s when I was sort of hanging out in college and what have you. And I think the problem is that Israeli / the Jews, because they've all been kind of conflated into one thing, have become the same as South Africans were back in the day. It's okay to hate South Africans, it was okay to hate South Africans at college, and it's now okay to hate Jewish people in a way that, you know, yes, my trans kid will face sort of hatred outside on the street and what have you, but not in college. In college, you're not allowed to hate trans people, and rightfully so. You're also not allowed to hate Muslim people but it's okay. It has become okay to hate Jewish people. And that surprised me because I'm surprised by a number of my friends who have started sort of making anti-Semitic statements that I never would have believed, you know.
But are they saying, is it anti-Semitic or anti the Israeli government's actions?
No, it's straight up anti-Semitic stuff that, you know, like stuff that's come up that, you know, about the Jews.
Yeah, but is that just an ill-informed sort of outburst? But the basis of it is an objection to the actions of the Israeli government, but it comes out in a clumsy way.
I kind of get the sense, and I don't know for sure, but I kind of get the sense that there's been a fair amount of, you know, in the same way that if you go back 20 years, it wasn't okay to say bad things about East Indians and West Indians and black people. And now all of a sudden that's come out. I think the anti-Semitism was always there and it's been released, basically. I think now it's okay. They feel like they can get away with it now, whereas they couldn't before.
But is that more of a piece of people feeling that they, this sort of sense of that they've been bottled up and unable to express themselves, unable to call a spade, unable to converse in the way that we used to in the 1970s, that feeling never went away for all of marginalised groups, all of the people that were sort of different from the mainstream, the gay people, people of colour and so on. And now there just seems to be like a feeling in the air. Oh, it's okay to say that stuff now. And the lid's been blown off the pot. And it's all this sort of bile is just pouring out. And it's not necessarily directed specifically at Jewish people. It's just directed at everybody that is different.
Yeah, no, fair enough. But if you're in a college, I doubt anybody could get away with, you know, I'm trying not to say anything inappropriate on the radio, but the terms that we would use for gay kids or
I'm not sure you're right. I mean, the picture you're painting of college life is I don't know. It's a sort of it's almost like a sort of a Norman Rockwell idea of how university life is. You know, just because you go to university doesn't mean to say that you're not just as full of hate and enmity as somebody who didn't get 2 A's in their A-levels. I don't think that you automatically become liberal and welcoming just because you're studying quantum mechanics.
No, I'm not saying that, Nick, but there is a culture in college, developed a culture in college of sort of left-wing liberalism, which is a good thing. And traditionally, the only people that would sort of allow that their bile out with the kids on the, with the rugby team, the engineers, and over here the football players, right? They were just as stupid as they were in the civilian world. But for everybody else, when you got to college, no matter what you felt inside, there was a culture that you kept, you knew you had to keep your mouth shut. That wasn't acceptable here.
Yeah, was. That's right. But I think that for people of all intelligence, that the sort of brakes are off now, and you can let your inner ire out.
Well, I would agree in the general population. I think in college it tends to only be directed towards Israel, George Soros / the Jews, and George Soros was always the that was always the sort of the code word for the Jews, right? You know, my friends would go, would start talking about, this is all the fault of George Soros. I'm like, one guy did all of this. Come on,
tell them to get off social media. Thanks, Nick. 0345 6060 973. Luton. Hello, Chris.
Nick. Yeah, I just think it's absolute nonsense. I mean, it's absolutely clear now the difference between Jewish people and, what the Israeli government have done. And we know there's tens of thousands of Jews around the world who are protesting as much as us, liberal lefties, about what the Israeli government have done, and the IDF. And unfortunately, there's a large proportion of Israeli people who support what they've done. But nevertheless, it's not to do with Jewish people. It's to do with, the Z word, Zionism, and the fact that the way they've behaved. And it just does my name because,
You can't conflate an objection to what a government does with the people of that country. That they're different.
That's it. And they just want us to, keep saying the anti-Semitism. And, for what it's worth, I'm a very small part Jewish, but it's really not to do with, as I say, I repeat myself, but there's thousands and thousands of Jews who are absolutely against it. And unfortunately, if I was a Jewish student and there'd been lots of protests and I had views that were, supporting the Israeli government, well, you've got every reason to feel sort of a little bit threatened, I suppose, if particularly if you're going around waving a, Israeli flag around. But it's, and I just think it's fantastic that so many people turned out yesterday. I mean, I couldn't go personally, my friends did, because it's, you've got Trump, who's got the attention span of a goldfish. Now he hasn't got the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, is he going to stick with it?
We'll see. Thanks a lot, Chris. He was ineligible for the Nobel Peace Prize this year because the nominations closed in January, and I think he'd been president for only 9 days at that point. But no doubt he will be eligible next year, and as he does seem to be determined to get it, the Nobel Peace Prize, I think because Barack Obama, his nemesis, got one, well, maybe he will stick with it. And fingers crossed for, the entire process. Let's hope it works out really well. The number here is 0345 6060 973. Guildford. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi there. Good evening.
Jonathan.
I believe that it's very strange. David Cameron said the big society and the floodgates are open for all foreigners, and that's a good thing because we get a lot of qualified doctors and whatnot, chefs. But I do feel a little inkling that the average English man and woman feels like the minority.
The minority?
Yes.
In what sense? The country has been taken over by an invasion of foreigners?
I'm sad to say, slightly yes. My friend sends me TikTok videos, sent me one of London High Street, and it was full of Muslims, and there wasn't one white person there. I'm not racist, I'm not xenophobic, but it's just a bit kind of like, we've got the English villages, they're all like, cosy. We've got the towns, they're all right, and then we've got the cities, and it's blowing a minefield. and the cultures don't get along sometimes. And you
interesting about London is that the cultures do seem to get along. You know, London is the most successful city in the country by far, and if you removed London from the country, then this would be one of, if not the poorest the poorest country in Western Europe. So the idea that, that foreigners can't mix in a city with, a lot of different coloured faces in it is not one that would function well is blown out of the water by the success of London. I mean, London is a significantly better and a more cohesive place than Clacton, for instance. And in Clacton, the absolute opposite is the case. You could walk around Clacton from now until the end of time and you wouldn't see anybody that's not white. It's not doing very well.
Yeah, diversity you're talking about, I think.
Well, it's a big melting pot, is what it is. All of the talents from all of the world are here.
Yeah, but aren't we as individuals entitled to our own opinions, or are our own opinions frowned upon or judged?
Well, it depends on what those opinions are and who your audience is.
Ah, yeah, good answer.
Thanks, Jonathan. 0345 6060 973. Now, I'll come to more of your thoughts on this. Do you think that the universities and colleges in this country do have an anti-Semitism problem? Incidences reported of anti-Semitic incidents went up 117% year to year. That was, I don't have this year's figures, but it was 2023 to 2024. Now, 117% does sound like a lot, but it only amounts to 272 incidents, which is less than one incident per college per year. So are we overreacting, perhaps? I mean, there was also a 19% increase in religious hate crimes targeted at Muslims. And yet, that's not in this directive from Bridget Phillipson, which has been sent to our universities. What are your thoughts on this? 0345 6060 973. What are your thoughts on this to come? I'm going to take a news break. We're going to talk briefly about the China spy case, which collapsed last month. You might have heard about that. We'll discuss that next with a security expert. Just past 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
President Trump has declared the war in Gaza is over. He's made the claim while flying to Egypt for tomorrow's multinational talks on his peace plan for the Middle East. A woman's being held by police investigating the deaths of two children in Staffordshire. She's due to be questioned on the suspicion of murder after the pair were found in Stafford this morning. And President Zelensky says a Ukrainian counteroffensive has made gains against Russia in the Zaporizhia region. He's been using his nightly video address to say that Kyiv's troops have advanced 3 kilometres. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in the west, cloudier for eastern areas, and we'll see patchy fog across England and Scotland, and a low of around 8 degrees.
This is LBC.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year, mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
At ulizprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulizprosperity.com.
Oh, must be the new parent posse chat. We're not even new. Our kids are 8. Or, as Eddie says, 96 months. He moved off grid. Can confirm he's still on grid. And he's got another one on the way. He won't have the coverage to live stream the birth. Will he?
Well, here at Tesco Mobile, we've made sure he has 99% network coverage. So he could if he wanted to.
Oh, sign me up.
It pays to be connected. Tesco Mobile. Every little helps. Over 99% UK population coverage on 4G.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. There's over £2 million worth of cash prizes to be won. And a chance to get your hands on some epic prizes. Go on, it's your go. 18 plus, UK, ends 21st of October. Selected menu items, app may be required, may depend on winning moment. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Keir Starmer's National Security Advisor apparently played no role in the collapse of a prosecution against two alleged Chinese spies. And he has the Prime Minister's full confidence, so said a cabinet minister doing the rounds today. Let's talk about this with Dr. Dan Lomas. Dr. Lomas is an international security expert. Good evening, Doctor.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate your time. So what is the background to this story, then?
So the context of this is the arrest of two individuals, Chris Cash and Chris Berry, who were charged in the Official Secrets Act of 1911 last spring. And the case was due to end up in the courts this year and subsequently collapsed, particularly around allegations that the case had been nobbled by the UK government because of concerns about wider influence and trading relations with China. Obviously, the governments have gone on record to deny that, but this story is something that's now become a political ball game that's refused to die off.
It's curious, though, that this Labour government is being attacked for the collapse of the case, but it did begin under a Conservative government that these alleged offences took place.
Yes. Well, the wider problem to this is, I think, that China question has been a problem for both, obviously, Keir Starmer's current government, but also Conservative governments going all the way back to Theresa May and Boris Johnson. And governments have tried to reset the UK's relationship. Listeners might remember the Golden Age and the David Cameron, George Osborne, where the UK saw China as a potential target for UK investment. But we've seen over the years China being recognised as, yes, a security threat, but on the other hand, UK governments have always been quite keen to court China as a potential target for UK investment. And also, let's not forget Chinese investment in the UK, and there have been a number of controversial issues regarding China's role, for example, in the 5G digital infrastructure, which Boris Johnson stripped out. And there's also concerns about Chinese investment in the UK's nuclear infrastructure. Again, that's something that's been addressed. But the broader issue of whether or not China uses trade as a potential threat against the UK is something that's still in the air. And that's, again, it comes back to the heart of this question.
Well, it's an interesting point, but you know, a country that is using trade as a threat to this country is more visibly America these days.
Well, there have been concerns raised in this case, and I noticed that that Sunday Times raised the issue of U.S. concerns about this case and the UK stance towards China. I think that when it comes to broader intelligence and security arrangements, I think that yes, there is a period of tension between the UK and U.S. over trade, particularly steel tariffs, and we've seen obviously Keir Starmer go to Washington and develop this relationship with Donald Trump. But in terms of close security ties, and in particular intelligence liaison between the US and the UK, we remain remarkably close. That said, you know, we have seen officials in the United States start to be concerned about the UK's security stance and the potential ripple effects of this case.
It is a complicated relationship that Britain has with China, though, isn't it? I mean, we collaborate on business. There was this big announcement of a wind turbine manufacturing deal that was just announced, for instance. They are completely embedded in our trade and electronics infrastructure, and yet, at the same time, they're seen as an enemy. It's a strange relationship.
Yes, and I think that When we're thinking about China, you know, yes, there are those security ties, but we're also thinking about the broader international scene here, that China, regardless of what we think about its political system, remains embedded within the international system generally. It's tied into the global economy. It is a major player on the global stage when it comes to dealing with issues like global warming, climate change, and security situation in the Asia-Pacific region. And it remains, you know, a top power at the United Nations, which means that, you know, countries are still forced to engage with China. I think that this comes back again to the problem that Labour and Conservative governments have constantly faced. It's much easier, as in the case of Russia, to kind of label Russia as a national security threat and an enemy of the UK because of its actions in Ukraine and the ongoing situation against NATO and other similar allies. That sort of situation is not the same when it comes to China, because you have that, as you've rightly acknowledged, that trade dimension there. And I think one of the issues regarding this spy case is that, yes, although the two individuals will deny that they were involved in spying for the People's Republic of China, the evidence that we've seen tends to suggest that it is highly likely they were engaging in some sort of espionage activity that got into the hands of the Chinese. But I guess the concern from the government is, do you really want to derail Britain's relationship with China over this particular case itself? And there may be kind of other further issues in the future, I think, that could potentially pose further problems that might be of a bigger scale.
So are you saying that it comes down to money?
I think not just money and trade is one factor, I think. I think governments have to pick and choose their battles. That there are numerous countries out there that do engage in spying activity. And the world of espionage, beyond kind of the US-UK special relationship, I'd say there are no friends when it comes to international intelligence partnerships, and the allies will even from time to time spy on each other. I think in this case, yes, there is kind of that trade backdrop, the diplomatic relation backdrop, but we also probably need to think of the technicalities of the legislation that the two individuals were charged on back in 2024. So when they were first arrested, it was on the 1911 Official Secrets Act that, as part of that, the burden of proof is on having to suggest that they were providing information to a quote enemy to be charged on that piece of legislation. And I think the issue in this case is labeling China as an enemy. I think that if these two individuals had been arrested much later, following the introduction of the UK's National Security Act, which aims to revise and update some of the legislation around this, I think that we would have perhaps seen a different outcome to the case. And, you know, given the evidence, and again, just to reiterate, although they deny allegations of spying, some of the stuff that we've seen being repeated in the media seems fairly damning, and I would say that I think we would see a different outcome if the National Security Act had been used, where the burden of proof is not necessarily there about saying that someone is spying for an enemy. You just need to prove that they're passing information on to a foreign state.
So it's a question of semantics then, because I believe that the government said, you know, given one of the reasons that it wasn't going to pursue the case was that at the time, China was not perceived as an enemy. It was perceived as an epoch-defining challenge.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the consensus across government is that China is a threat. And there have been numerous speeches by the heads of MI5 and MI6, Secret Intelligence Service, and even GCHQ, saying that China poses a significant threat to the UK, and it's ranked up there alongside terrorism, Iran, and Russia as a threat to the UK. But in terms of defining what a threat means, there's a whole series of terms used. So, you know, you've referred to this epoch defining a potential threat. We've also seen that it's a challenger or a major challenge to the UK. So I think that, you know, although many people would recognise that China poses a threat, and some people would say it poses an enemy, I think it's a big step for a government to openly say in the international arena that China is an enemy, because that in turn has particular implications on trading and diplomatic relationships between states.
I mean, of course, it's not the first time that a foreign government has been accused of interference in our affairs. Russia has been accused many times, and many stories of potential and actual foreign influence in government. The Russia report on Brexit interference declared that it was likely that the government had, in effect, looked the other way rather than find out what was happening. Reform Party has had allegations of evidence of Russian interference, and now this. Is it's the only kind of story that appears in the press infrequently, but is it actually much more frequent a phenomenon than we are aware of?
Well, certainly I think that, you know, that threats come and go, and that listeners may remember kind of the Litvinenko case over a decade ago now, and the Skripal case. I think, you know, in the case of the Skripal affair in 2018, it was much clearer that the Russians had been involved in this. There was an evidence chain quite literally across Salisbury. And following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it was much easier for the UK government to do things against Russian assets and also Russian intelligence officers. There was, remember, a mass expulsion of Russian diplomats, in inverted commas, who were actually intelligence officers engaging spying against the UK. So I think that, you know, there are events that take place that make it much easier for the UK to subsequently respond. I think in the case of China, we've not had that on the same scale yet. So I think in the case of these two individuals, they're engaging in relatively low-level espionage activity that, yes, is of benefit to China. But again, the consideration here is, I guess, do you kind of disrupt completely the UK's trading and political relationship with the People's Republic over this particular case? And that's an important consideration, I think, for any government to make.
Now, you've alluded to it, and we would never admit it, but is it likely that we are doing the exact same things to our perceived enemies as we're alleging that China is doing to us?
Yeah, the UK remains a global player when it comes to intelligence collection. The UK's Foreign Intelligence Service, the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, and GCHQ, the UK's Signals Intelligence Agency, you know, are collecting intelligence against Russia, China, and Iran. It's worth saying that they're probably much harder targets than any liberal democracy out there, because the things you can do in a totalitarian state are probably a lot less. But we saw a few weeks ago MI6 launch a new online platform in the dark web called Silent Courier, which was a way for foreign nationals to provide information and provide contact with MI6. So we are seeing, you know, that the UK's intelligence agencies are engaging in this activity overseas. The extent to which they're doing this is probably a lot less than China. China's espionage activity tends to be a collect-it-all approach, whereas the UK, US, and other agencies tends to be fairly targeted in the types of individuals that they are recruiting, i.e. high-profile government officials. But all states, you know, engage in this. You know, some people tend to have this, a kind of liberal approach to international affairs, believing that there are friends out there. But espionage against both friends, enemies, and threats has been a long part of the international system.
And just finally, given that he is undoubtedly privy to more information than us, should we assume that if the National Security Advisor says that pursuing a case is not in the national interest, that he's right?
Well, again, it's one of the prerogatives, I guess, of an official. Seeing information is that, you know, senior officials in government will get a range of information from a whole variety of sources. Secret intelligence is just one thing which people often obsess about because it's got top secret stamps on it, or it appears sexy, in terms of the organisations that have provided it. But when we think about government, you know, intelligence is just one dimension of the information flow, and you know, ministers sometimes use intelligence. They will use it to shape policy, but on other occasions, you know, ministers and senior officials will sometimes overlook, or they will neglect intelligence, perhaps because it doesn't fit a broader picture here. And that, you know, we might be seeing that in this case. But again, I think, you know, there are further questions that perhaps the Foreign Affairs Committee and other committees in Parliament will be asking, and we might get more information.
Very good to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for that. That's international security expert Dr. Dan Lomas. Now we're going to take a short break and then come back with more of your thoughts about the incidence of anti-Semitism on campus and whether you think it warrants the government threatening action, undefined, against universities if they don't stamp it out. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Unflinching.
I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
Unyielding.
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. No.
And at times, for many, uncomfortable.
What a policy. Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer.
Tomorrow marks 100 years since the birth of Margaret Thatcher. In a special show, we'll assess the legacy of the Iron Lady.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Calling all little wildlife explorers. Playmobil is now in Happy Meal. Look, is that a seal? And a sea turtle? They've been around for millions of years, just like me. Which will your little ones discover? Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 14th of October, from 11 a.m, Playmobil can price toys only, subject to availability.
Did you know that if you buy your train tickets early, you could get a better price with Southeastern Advance Tickets? Whether you're planning a fun family day out or heading into town for a meeting, the earlier you buy, the cheaper your ticket could be. See our terms and conditions to check if it's the right ticket for you. Don't leave it to the last minute. Buy your advance train tickets now from the Southeastern app or website and pay no booking fees.
Southeastern.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we were talking before about the incidents of anti-Semitic attacks or incidents on campuses in this country. The government has written to vice-chancellors urging them to take steps to protect Jewish students as part of the government's efforts to stamp out anti-Semitism. And the universities have been threatened with action, which has been undefined, as far as I'm aware, if Jewish students are not protected from harassment. 600 training sessions are going to be offered to university staff to help them identify harassment. Do lecturers at university really need a training session to identify harassment? 0345 6060 973. Bootle, hello, John.
Hi, Nick. The point I wanted to make was, I mean, I have some issues with the international definition of anti-Semitism, but one of the clauses that I vehemently support is that conflation of the actions of Israel with that of all Jews, the same as is anti-Semitism, the same as it would be for conflating the actions of the KKK with Christians and Islamic extremists with all Muslims. But when protests specifically against Israel are being labelled as anti-Semitic, are they not then completing that anti-Semitic trope by saying that the protests are against all Jewish people?
Well, I suppose there's a point there, yes.
It's something that the right to protest in this country is a fundamental principle, and as I said to your producer on the line, we've obviously got to concede that there are people within protest that will go further, and the actual anti-Semitism in this country has to be rooted out. But to label peaceful protest against specifically the actions of Israel as anti-Semitic is, for me, not welcome. It's not something that should be entertained in this country.
Well, I mean, I haven't been on one of these protests, but I've seen videos and I've talked to people who have, and it doesn't seem that those protests are they're anti the Jewish people. They are specifically anti the actions of the Israeli government in a specific area, and to label them to be otherwise is, I think, to not be entirely truthful about it. So, yeah, I take your point there, John. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. Joe says, I'm a maths teacher in a Jewish school in North London, and when my British Jewish students walk in the street, they get shouted at, free Palestine. They are British Jews, not Israeli. Poor kids, that is proof of anti-Semitism. Yeah, well, you could say the same for any minority, I suppose. They all get shouted at in the street. Ask trans people how they're received when they go about their daily business. Ask gay people. Ask people of colour. Ask people who are perceived to be insufficiently patriotic and take down the flags that have been carelessly attached to lampposts. You know, there's a lot of hatred about, and I don't think that universities are at fault. I think if you want to really point the finger of blame, then it's at the social media giants, because those are the ones whose business model is to foment hatred and fear. And it's by that method that they can keep you glued to their sites. And they're doing very well from it. Very well. 0345 6060 973. Sevenoaks. Hello, Mark.
Hi. I think one of the problems is that the government seems to have labelled secularism as anti-Semitic. Now, secularism is the idea that people don't want the state to give religious organisations legal powers over people, and they want the state to be the state for all people. So in the case of Israel, Israel, according to mainstream politicians there, they want Israel to be a Jewish state, and they say that people who don't want that are anti-Semitic. But secularists are not specifically worried about Israel. That's a view they take about all states, and they approve, for example, the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which guarantees secularism. Most people in this country, I think,
I thought it was about free speech. Is that in there too? I haven't actually
Congress
read it.
Congress shall establish no religion.
Right.
That is in there as well. It is. You're right. It is about free speech as well. But and I think most people in this country are secularists in that they don't want. They don't want religious organisations to be given powers over them.
Well, most people now don't ally with one religion or another, and I think the majority of us don't believe in God. I'd have to check that, but I think it's more or less true.
Yes, but so I think that the trouble is that there are people like some Israeli mainstream politicians that want to push the idea that Israel should remain a non-secularist state, and they have tried with some success to get the government to label secularists as anti-Semitic.
And I'm going to have to move on, Mark, but I think that protests have been labelled as anti-Semitic that aren't, and we've covered that ground already, so I appreciate that, but I'm running out of time. I want to fit in Anna in Hendon. Hello, Anna.
Hello. The Jewish community in this country is only about 300,000. So although the number may seem small to you of anti-Semitic incidents, it's quite substantial in comparison with the number of Jewish students that we're talking about. I mean, you have to also remember, Jewish schools have had to have security for the last 30 or 40 years. So it's not something that we're imagining. I mean, when kids, Jewish kids get attacked in the street, if they're not escorted to school by their parents, there's something wrong with this country, quite honestly. And if Jewish students are blocked from going to lectures because they're Jewish or because they've got their head covered, you know, there's something wrong. And it should be stopped.
Yep, well, you get no argument from me there. Thanks, Anna.
And that's exactly what we're asking for, that's all. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Messages on this. Sid says, there were a lot of Israelis celebrating the genocide in Gaza. Why is there a two-tier justice system? And Daniel in Wilsdon says, the difference between anti-Semitism and other forms of discrimination on university campuses is that all other marginalised people are respected and their cause is championed by the students. I'm not sure that's true. That's too sweeping a statement there, Daniel. I don't think there's any evidence for that. But appreciate your responses on this. We're going to change it up after the news. Coming up, women and girls over the age of 12 have been banned by a high-profile London mosque from taking part in a so-called inclusive and family-friendly charity fun run. Maybe you took part in the run in London's Victoria Park this morning. If so, let me know what happened. If not, would you have liked to take part, or does a men-only fun run outrage you? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. It's expected Hamas will hand over the remaining living Israeli hostages it's been holding in Gaza later this morning as part of Washington's peace plan for the Middle East. They were abducted during the 7th of October attacks 2 years ago. On Sunday evening, the Israeli government said it thinks the group of 20 will be freed together. But the British-Israeli peace activist Danielle Bett has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC more hard work lies ahead when it comes to the future of Gaza.
Of course, the most important thing is to secure the return of the hostages and ensure that Gazans have aid and that the ceasefire holds. But we have to think more long-term how we're actually going to manage rebuilding the Gaza Strip, ensuring Israel's security, and managing in a way that doesn't involve Hamas. And that means that a different political alternative for Palestinians needs to be offered. So we'll have to work with, for example, the Palestinian Authority.
President Trump has declared the war in Gaza is over. He's made the claim while flying to Egypt for multinational talks on his peace plan designed to end the fighting between Israel and Hamas. A group of leading economists is suggesting the Chancellor could raise tens of billions of pounds through tax reform without breaking Labour's manifesto promises. The government's under pressure to balance the books ahead of November's autumn statement, while being warned a £50 billion black hole could be lurking in the public finances. The Institute for Fiscal Studies says Rachel Reeves should resist simply hiking rates without changing the tax system. The leader of the Conservatives has written to the Prime Minister over the collapse of a court case against two men accused of being Chinese spies. Kemi Badenoch calling for senior ministers to address the comments about what happened. She's also criticising Keir Starmer for travelling to Egypt for the talks in the Middle East. The UK security and intelligence expert Dan Lomas has been talking to LBC.
The case was due to end up in the courts this year and subsequently collapsed, particularly around allegations the case had been nobbled by the UK government because of concerns about wider influence and trading relations with China. Obviously, the governments have gone on record to deny that.
And a man's due in court later on today over allegations of assault against two people at Aberdeen's Royal Infirmary. The 37-year-old was charged after part of the site was evacuated briefly on Friday evening. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in western areas overnight. Cloudier in the east, though, with patchy fog across England and Scotland. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
A mosque has banned women and girls over the age of 12 from competing in a charity park run. The fundraising event called the Muslim Charity Run and organised by the East London Mosque allows a 5 kilometre route, a 5 kilometre route and took place today. However, the event has been accused of discrimination for allowing only men, boys of any age, and girls aged 12 and under to take part. Let's talk about this with Aisha Ali Khan. She is a human rights activist. Good evening, Aisha.
Hello, Nick.
What do you make of this story?
I'm so disappointed. Obviously, I found out this morning, and my first initial reaction was, I cannot believe in 2025 we are still living in this way where women and girls are being segregated and they're basically told effectively just to sit down. And the boys and men are given this opportunity to, for example, in this instance, it was to take part in this charity run. But generally, it's been something that I experienced firsthand growing up in a small town just outside of Bradford. And I genuinely believed, you know, all this time later, things would have been improved.
Do you think that we're making too much of this, though? Because it is just a fun run.
It's not just a fun run, and it's easy to think, oh, it's a one-off event and we can just, you know, forget about it and move on. But the message is actually it's more systematic, and what we're seeing is women and girls are kind of being ignored. And I've seen, obviously I've experienced this myself, and I've seen this growing up. Go to any mosque space, and traditionally men will have the biggest space, the biggest room, the better access, and women's access to mosques will be at the back of the mosque or a side entrance and so on. Things have improved over the last 20 years, and that's because people like organizations like the Inclusive Mosque Initiative have campaigned, and we've worked with the Charities Commission to talk about this. But overall, things are still the same because we have a East London Mosque, taking their time to organise an event and then effectively telling 50% of the population, you can't take part. If they were genuinely concerned about, oh, we don't want to free mix, which is the term given to Muslims mixing from both genders, well, why wasn't there an event organised for women and girls to take part? And another issue for me, Nick, is about the health element. We saw what happened 5 years ago. South Asian communities were massively affected by COVID, and obviously disproportionately the numbers of people who passed away and who were affected and are still affected by the way by long COVID. So health is such an important issue. We suffer from illnesses like high blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes. It's a very disproportionate landscape when you think about it compared to other communities. So being healthy is such an important part, should be an important part of our faith as well. And what better than a mosque to reiterate that, to reinforce that message. So yeah, I think it goes beyond this one-off event, in my opinion.
So are women specifically excluded from sports events as a matter of course among Muslim communities?
Absolutely, they are. I mean, we've seen recent years, we've seen people, organizing things like hiking groups and so on. But traditionally, growing up, there wasn't anything available for a Muslim woman or a girl to take part in and access. There were very few women-only gyms. And even now, we've had all these studies that have been published. Recently, there was a really big study published in by a charity called the Sweaty Betty Foundation, and they actually spoke to numerous schoolgirls in Bradford and a number of other locations. And one of the biggest things that the girls said was just access to sports, and the only access they get is at school. They don't do anything after school. They're not allowed to do anything after school. Many of the, there's not many opportunities or facilities locally anyway. So even if they wanted to, they can't. And obviously, as you know, we live in this country, amazing country, that gets dark really early in the winter months. So even going out and about for a run or so on afterwards, after work and after school, sorry, is problematic because of the safety issues that we face as women and girls, not just Muslim women and girls, by the way, but across all different communities. We always worry about being out alone at night time, being out even when we're with other girls, other women as well. Our safety is always an issue. So yeah, it is an issue. And I think, I mean, so many people, because I posted it in the morning, and so many people have messaged me privately to say, you know, this is, you know, thank you for talking about this, thank you for pointing it out. A few people have also mentioned that, oh, we don't want to say anything because we don't want to say it's a mosque and contribute to this far-right sort of messaging that's already targeting ethnic minorities, that are already targeting Muslim men, so we didn't want to say anything. But I think as a Muslim woman who likes to say it, I think it's important we talk about it and we reinforce the idea that in our faith, in Islam, being healthy is such an important part of it. We're encouraged to eat well, we're encouraged to exercise, we're encouraged to look after our health and not overindulge, not take drugs, for example, or smoke or eat the wrong foods. So why isn't this message getting to the communities with the mosque as well, and not just to the men, but to women as well?
And when you give this message, is there an awakening of understanding that perhaps the what has been traditional in that community is something that they maybe want to think about changing, or is there a vigorous pushback?
Well, I think we're going to see the reaction over the next few days, Nick. I've already had a few messages responding to my posts to say, well, Islam forbids mixing of the genders, it's not acceptable, and therefore it shouldn't be done. And I feel that is a bit of a cop-out, because it's almost like saying, well, yes, okay, Islam expects us to behave in a certain way, and this is obviously the reasoning why I think the East London Mosque went with, well, we can't have men and women and girls and boys mixing, therefore it's better just to tell the girls and the women to sit this one out, for example. But actually, Islam actually tells us to look after our bodies, our health. So why aren't we promoting that? Segregation is important for some people. I don't believe in this, by the way. But our health comes first, more than anything. And I think that's the message that always gets lost when we have these kinds of incidents that happen.
The website describes the event as being a family-friendly and inclusive atmosphere, which is odd, because it then goes on to state it was open to men, boys of all ages, and girls under 12. Is there a religious significance to the age 12?
Well, traditionally, that is the kind of point at which puberty starts. Obviously, we know now, medically, we know that could happen any time earlier, and it could happen any time later. There's no set defined period of time where it's not like a switch, basically, where 12 years old and therefore you've entered puberty. But traditionally, that has been considered a point at which girls especially will start their periods and they'll start to go through the changes from moving into adulthood. And I think that was their thinking, perhaps. But traditionally, yes, puberty affects both boys and girls around that time.
Right. You know, gender separation is also practiced in other religions. I mean, some Orthodox Jewish communities, for instance. Do you think that much of the outrage that has been aimed at this fun run is an example of double standards? Because I don't recall any controversy over the gender separation among some Jewish communities, for instance.
I think, look, we're living in the UK, and tries to go here the chief exec of Muslim Women Network UK, she made a really good point today in one of the newspaper articles where, you know, we are governed by the Equality Act, and by stopping girls from participating, women and girls, there could well be a breach. And everybody, not just the Muslim community, but like you've just mentioned, the Jewish community, we are all, we all have to participate, and we all have signed up to this act. So I think it's important to call this inequality out, whether it's my community, whether it's my religion, whether it's another religion, because this kind of inequality doesn't just stop, you know, when your children, childhood, it actually follows us into adulthood. And I remember when I was young and I used to play with my brothers and my cousins in the local park, and so on. And once the segregation sets in, we're not allowed to take, you know, to take, you know, part in certain things. But also it then carries on into our adulthood as well. This idea that certain things are acceptable for boys to do, but not acceptable for girls to do. And also that's the age where gender roles are introduced and reinforced. So, for example, you know, girls will be expected to stay inside the house and learn how to cook and clean and enter into kind of the serving roles that they're, you know, when they get married, the traditional roles of serving their husband's families, for example. And this is something that I've experienced myself, and I've seen happen to my friends as well. And I've never been happy with it. I've never been accepting of it, because it's just fundamentally really unfair.
You know, one of the criticisms that is that has been levelled at the Muslim community from some individuals is that they do not act in a way that represents traditional British values. And yet, those very same people would fulminate about men participating in women's sports. Is this not just a single gender sporting event, which is the norm for competitive events?
No, Nick. Running is not something... No, I can't accept that. I think people are always going to find something to disagree with and so on. But today, I mean, all the comments and everything I've seen online, everybody seems to be of the same opinion that this is something that... the ban, sorry, of against women and girls should not have happened. This isn't something that is just only boys, men and boys can do. This is something, running is something I used to enjoy. I used to love running until I got sciatica, so I've not been able to run medical grounds. But it's something that I've always enjoyed and something that kept me fit for many years. And I think it's unfair that girls aren't allowed to develop that passion, that joy, that love for sport. And it's not just running, there are other sports as well. And again, it's that discouraging of girls, this, you know, and women being healthy and fit.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but are you saying that it's not just specific to this event that happened today, but that in general... girls and women over the age of 12 are dissuaded from exercising in your community?
I think this is my first-hand experience. I know for a fact when I was growing up, I would see my brothers and my cousins play football, for example, whereas we didn't. We weren't allowed to. My other friends my age, similar age to me, they weren't interested. There wasn't that passion there. But I feel that that was because we weren't introduced the idea that, yes, you could play. Yes, you could be competitive. Yes, you could be good at this. Obviously, things have changed over the years, Nick. I've seen many young girls now. They go to the gym. They play football. They play competitively and so on. And we're seeing things like you know, girls entering the boxing ring, for example, which is really good. I'm really pleased to see this. But my concern, when I saw the headline this morning, that girls have been told, no, you, women and girls were told, no, you can't take part. My concern was, the message that's going out to the girls from those from that community, which is East London, so it would predominantly be Bangladeshi girls, women and girls, the message that was being transmuted to those girls and boys is that, no, this is not for girls. It's only for boys.
But it's the same message, really, that we've had in this country until relatively recently. Girls were not encouraged to play football, and to show a women's football match on television was absolutely unheard of. It's only in the last few years that it's been an acceptable part of British life. And I'd say also that, you know, men-only clubs for mostly rich white men are a celebrated part of the British establishment. Most of those clubs in St. James were, well, many still are, but almost all of them were completely men only. So it's not just the Muslim community that's playing catch up on this, the whole country is.
Well, look, you hit the nail on the head. We didn't have women's football when we were growing up, but now we do. In the last 10 years, we've seen a huge shift, not just obviously people wanting to watch women's football, but on TV as well, you know, broadcasters and advertisers and so on. So obviously there's still a massive gap between what male footballers are earning and what women footballers are earning right now. But hopefully that is going to become narrower as time goes on. But this, just the complete banning of girls and women and girls is going backwards, isn't it?
Well, if the situation doesn't change, do you think that you know, this discrimination that you've talked about, not including women on the same level as men within the Muslim community, do you think that might actually cause women who are of the Muslim faith to renounce that faith?
I think what it will cause is people being unhappy. And I don't think, faith is a very personal thing, so it would be completely inappropriate of me to say this is going to be enough for somebody to walk away. There are so many inequalities, and this is just one example of women being treated differently, of having different expectations, of having different roles, and, you know, not being able to fulfill our full potential because of these expectations and these kind of barriers that we're constantly facing and constantly having to overcome. So, yeah, it's always more of a challenge having to navigate our sort of way forward compared to, say, for example, the path for the boys.
Yes. Aisha, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for that. That's human rights activist Aisha Ali Khan. So what do you make of this? Is it that it's just another example of women being treated differently that is common in all communities? Or do religious groups in general have a problem with women? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
One of the most important things for me is to break that cycle of addiction. It stops with me. And to do that, I knew that I had to get better. And I had to show my boys that, okay, I've got a really big problem. I'm willing to solve it.
Start your recovery with Priory. To learn more, visit priorygroup.com/breakthechain.
Add water to your will and know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So this is the story. A mosque banned women and girls over the age of 12 from competing in a charity park run. The fundraising event called the Muslim Charity Run and organised by East London Mosque follows a 5-kilometre route and took place earlier today. But the event has been accused of discrimination for allowing only a certain type of person to join in. On their website, in answer to the question, who can take part, they said, open to everyone. Runners, walkers and children, brackets, girls under 12 and boys of any age, plus family, friends and as spectators or volunteers. Whether you're taking part in the 5 kilometre run or cheering from the sidelines, you're welcome. But you're not, though, if you're half of the population, more or less. What do you make of this? 0345 6060 973. Greenwich. Debbie.
Oh, hello there. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, very much like that most of my life. Like, I mean, most people, like, live their lives and they're discriminated against because you're a woman. I mean, I was brought up in Southampton and then I went to Belfast and then I come back to London. And, like, my sisters... And my sisters were brought up in bread and jam. My brothers were brought up in fish and meat.
Huh.
And it's like the same sort of thing. Women were treated this way in England, the same as the Muslim people are. The women are treated knives, like we treated our women in this country.
Well, it's not
the
so
same
very...
way Muslim yes. treated are treated knives, like we were treated like that for years and years and years.
Well, it's only relatively recently that women have had any sort of level of equality. I mean, there's, you know, much evidence to suggest that it's still not quite there, even though the women outperform men educationally. And, you know, the situation has been improved somewhat as far as, you know, the glass ceiling is concerned and the makeup of boards of companies. But still, it lingers, doesn't it? This sense in society that women are somehow second-class citizens.
Well, it's coming back more since Donald Trump. It's been coming back more and more in this country than it ever was before. I mean, now the women in this country are treated worse because of the way that the world is. And the way that social media is, and women are treated like much worse than they were. Like when I was young, when I was like 20, I had more freedom than my great granddaughter. My granddaughter is 15, and my great grandson is 10. And the way that women are treated now is worse than when I was treated in the 1970s.
Really? In what way?
It's just the way that men look at women as if they're rubbish. Like, it's because of social media. It's not because of their fathers or their mothers, the way they brought them up. It's because of social media. But not only that, even this country, the Muslim ladies, the way they're talking, like, Muslims are very protective of their religion and because of the ladies, because they become, because they have their period and all that. I understand all that because, like, you got to stop the men from having these urges. That's what it's talking about. But men are responsible for the owner, just consequently in this country. But they're starting, the ladies, the Muslim ladies are beginning to stand up for their rights. And they realise that this country is different to the country that they originally came from. But...
Yes, change does not happen. Change has not happened at an equal rate all over the world. You could say it's maybe two steps forward, one step back in most places?
It is. Well, I watched Saving Private Ryan tonight on television. That was my film. And I thought, like, my husband's, like, born in 1945, so after the war. But when I think of it, they saved all the people from the Nazis and the Jews, and they were fighting against the Chinese and the Russians. You know, it's just the same sort of thing. But, you know, we've got to remember that we're here because they lost their lives. And we're here, you know. And, like, the next thing coming up is, like, the Russia and the Chinese. But, I mean, I know that Netanyahu must have to pay for his crimes.
Right, well, we're getting a bit off topic, Debbie. We dealt with that in previous hours, but thanks for that. What do you make of this? A fun run, which is supposedly open to everyone, as long as you're not a female over the age of 12. Ilford, G-Van.
Good evening, Nick. I
was listening to the presentation in the beginning with interest. The reason I said that is because it just so happens that this week, just gone, I actually had to see a doctor, and she's a female, a Muslim female, Dr. Ahmed. Now, the thing is, that does that mean in the Muslim community there aren't women doctors? That's nonsensical. If I may go further, in Asian cultures, we encourage women to achieve the highest level of profession that they can. Another example I can give you, my wife happens to be an electronics engineer. So, you know, in the profession, we encourage women to become professional. My daughter happens to be a corporate lawyer. But does that mean to say because she's a female, she cannot be a corporate lawyer? That's nonsense.
But what? Yes. But what do you make then of this? This
well, it's the
apparent
elderly,
discrimination. It was a family fun run.
No, no. If I may, this is being done by the elderly in the mosque rather than the people who are younger who are coming up in the stream. Do you understand? The elderly tend to still have the old concept that women are supposed to be domesticated, they must do this, they must do that for the family and so forth in future. That concept is now dying slowly. I mean, maybe it's still happening to some degree. Whoever's done this in the mosque is obviously the elderly committee of the mosque are promoting this with a female gender, if I may say so. It's not the younger generation. The younger generation will think positive and think in terms of let them move forward. Do you see what I'm saying?
All right. Good talk to you, Jeevan. Thanks for that. Oldgate, Abdul.
Good evening. Yeah. Just a quick question. Obviously, you guys are discussing this, but I'd like to say that under Islamic rules, a strange man and woman are not allowed to be doing anything together. They don't know each other. It's definitely not running together. You know what I mean?
But running side by side is not... Does that constitute
they think it's because they make it undue attention. The people will be staring, the man will be staring at the woman. The woman may be also attack the man. But just because of those sort of reasons.
Right.
And
what do you make of what the last caller said? That it's sort of the elders in the mosque that instituted this rule. And if it had been down to younger people, then they
wouldn't. Under Islamic rule, even I cannot run with a strange woman. I don't know. Like even from my own community, we shouldn't be like even talking together. It's not even allowed.
Right.
Just even talk to her.
Okay.
And it's like, it's something to do with business, or you know what I mean?
Right, okay. Two different sides of the coin. Different opinions coming from more or less the same place. Got it. Thanks, Abdul. I'm going to take a break for the news. More of your calls on this on the way. We're also going to talk about Prince Andrew, another revelation about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And before I leave at one, we're going to check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. It's 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
It's expected Hamas will hand over the remaining living Israeli hostages it's been holding in Gaza later this morning as part of Washington's peace plan for the Middle East. On Sunday evening, the Israeli government said it thought the group of 20 would be freed together. A group of leading economists is suggesting the Chancellor could raise tens of billions of pounds through tax reforms without breaking Labour's manifesto promises. The government's under pressure to balance the books ahead of November's autumn statement. And a man is due in court later on today over allegations of assault against two people at Aberdeen's Royal Infirmary. The 37-year-old was charged after part of the site was evacuated briefly on Friday evening. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in the west, cloudier for eastern areas with patchy fog and a low of around 8 degrees.
LBC.
Every supermarket has a premium range, but there's only one number one from Waitrose. With products like the number one Wagyu Topside Seasoned Roasting Joint, naturally marbled and meltingly tender. Or the number one Sticky Cinnamon Bun Pudding. Buttery, rich, and perfectly spiced. And the number one smoked silver fox cheddar. 18-month matured, oaky, and creamy. Food worth getting the fancy plates out for. Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Selected stores subject to availability.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. Play today with the Philly Cheese Stack, so you can enjoy two beef patties, crispy grilled onions, and a melted cheddar cheese sauce. Go on, it's your go. From 11 a.m. until the 21st of October, participating in restaurants, subject to availability, app may be required. 18 plus, UK, see mcdrules.co.uk.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Nick Abbott
on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
The Duke of York told Jeffrey Epstein that they were in this together the day after a picture of him with Virginia Giuffre was published. It's a further indication that the pair remained in touch despite the Duke's suggestions otherwise. Let's talk about this with Robert Jobson. Robert is the royal editor for The Standard and author of Our King, Charles III, The Man and the Monarch Revealed. Good evening, Robert.
Hello, Nick.
So, is this further... does it sort of go further than any story that we've heard about him so far? It seems a bit more of the same.
No, I think he's been caught out lying. That's the thing. He said he never spoke to... had anything to do with Epstein after 2010, and he has. So that's a lie. He was said that on television. So therefore, is in it together? Yeah, that sort of adds to it. We don't know what they're in together. I've interviewed the Duke of York about other things when he's 50. I don't have an axe to grind against him, but any cover-up, it seems to me, is worse than sometimes worse than the deeds. The trouble is, in this instance, we really don't know what the deeds were because nobody's actually been forced to testify in this case, either the victims involved in Prince Andrew or Andrew himself. So we're in a bit of a dilemma as we watch on. Well, my feeling is it's a bit of a reckoning for Andrew, and it's put the king in an invidious position.
I mean, to say that he's lying is a bit strong, isn't it? I mean, we are talking
about... Not really. He said it on the record that he never had any more contact with Epstein after 2010. He clearly did.
Yeah, but is he not recalling messages that he may or may not have sent from 14 years ago? I mean, can you remember what you sent to somebody 14 years ago and what the date
were? I can't remember what I said 40 minutes ago, but he did say very clearly that he had no more contact with this guy after 2010. He has done.
Right, so is it that in itself, or is it perhaps...
That in itself, yeah.
What about the actual content of the messages? Because one of the lines...
We don't know, really.
So. Well, one of the lines was, apparently, it would seem we are all... that we are in this together and we'll have to rise above it. Otherwise, keep in close touch and we'll play some more soon. 4!
Not great wording, is it?
I mean, do you think that there's any chance that the Duke of York has perhaps been unfairly treated here?
Yes.
I mean, I do.
I'm actually one of the people that have said that in the past. I think that there's a possibility of that. He could have been, duped by this guy over money, and it's not over sex and scandals. But, you know, the trouble is he's been given a lot of get-out-of-jail-free cards, really, and... At the end of the day, I don't know what he did. Nobody really knows but himself. And he says very categorically that he did nothing wrong. But a lot of people in this one, you know, the court of public opinion, which is not always right, say that there's no smoke without fire. And sometimes the cover-up is worse than the actual crime.
Yes, but is it just guilt by association? Because a lot is being made today about that Tony Blair met Jeffrey Epstein.
Exactly that. I mean, you know, that is the point. You could be guilt by association. This guy is a monster. There's no doubt about it. He's a dreadful person, and he's been found guilty, and his girlfriend Ghislaine Maxwell has been slung inside as well. But the reality is. Yes, he could be guilty by association. He hasn't had an opportunity to defend himself. My opinion was that he should have carried on, but he decided not to carry on with the court case because of the Queen's Jubilee. And he added, gave both the King, the current King, and the Queen assurances that he was not guilty. But for the first time ever, and I know maybe only a little thing, he's been found out lying because I'm telling you an untruth. Then is that he said he never had anything to do with this guy after 2010. Well, he did.
Do you think that part of this is that Andrew has had something of a cosseted upbringing, has a haughty nature, somewhat self-aggrandizing, and is not really used to having to defend himself?
Absolutely right. I mean, I remember interviewing him. Found him quite charming, actually, in a sort of strange way. I've also been on a plane with him when we were flying to Poland, and he was quite a decent guy there. He was chatting to a friend of mine and mine, a photographer on the way back about the events. He's not as pompous as some people say, and he's actually, he was a war hero. He's done things that a lot of other people haven't done. But I just say in this instance, his choice of friends is poor at best.
He still seems to enjoy quite the lifestyle. Has he paid any kind of price for his friendship with Epstein?
Well, I think he has. I mean, he's no longer a working member of the royal family. He can't use HRH title properly. He's been stripped of all his associations with charities and military organisations. I think he's paid a very high price now.
What does he live on? He doesn't get public money, does he?
Well, I'm sure we all were aware that Her Majesty the Queen was a very wealthy woman. I'm sure she would have left her son with enough money to live out the rest of his life.
What about the King? What favours does he enjoy from the King?
Not a lot, I wouldn't think. I mean, I think the King must be getting a little tired of the whole story. I think the King's got enough on his plate, living with cancer and trying to be head of state than worry about his brother's murky friendships with dodgy Americans.
Well, has there been any punishment, is perhaps too strong a word, but has there been any privations visited upon Andrew by Charles?
Well, as you said, Charles doesn't give... The King, His Majesty, doesn't give Andrew any money, so... Not sure that he can do it an awful lot.
But he is still residing in a royal palace, though, is he not?
He's residing in Royal Lodge, which was under contract. My understanding is Her Majesty, her late Majesty Elizabeth II gave the Duke of York a 75-year lease, of which he signed, and that's the point. So, you know, he's entitled to live there because he has a lease.
Right, but is that not something that is at Charles' discretion?
Not really. He's signed a lease.
Right, okay. It just seems odd that the King can't turf somebody out of one of his own properties, but... Okay.
Oh, well, it's not one of his own properties. It's not a royal residence. It's part of the Crown Estate, and it's not the same. It's not quite as easy as you think. And yes, I suppose if he wanted to physically kick him out of his house, he probably could, but I'm sure brothers, even if they're loggerheads, aren't going to want to actually make their own brother homeless. Maybe if it was Prince William, it might be different.
How badly do you think this has affected the royal family?
Very badly. Very badly indeed, in terms of the reputation and the brand of the monarchy, to be involved with a sleazebag like Epstein. It was a bad era by both the Duke and Duchess of York. I like Sarah personally. Bad era to get involved with this man.
But they were never the most popular of royals in the first place, were they, really? Have the public really made a decision about the entire family based on the actions of Andrew?
I don't think that's true. I think that, from my understanding anyway, I think that Andrew and Sarah were actually very popular in the 80s. I was quite young then, so I don't remember that. But it all went wrong in the 90s. But when I was a royal reporter on The Sun, so I remember that. But have they tarnished the entire family? I don't think so, no. But they haven't done them any favours.
Yeah, I'm looking at some polling that was done by Statista in August of this year. And it's quite stark, the support of the royal family based on age. If you're 65 and over... then the polling suggests that 81% of the 65-pluses support the monarchy. If you're 18 to 24, it's only 41%. That seems like as the 65-pluses fall off the conveyor belt of life, they're being replaced by people who don't really have a positive idea about the monarchy at all. Do you think they're on a permanent decline?
I think they're going to watch it. I think they're on a sticky wicket. I think that these young people... I've got a point in what's their view. Obviously, as you get older, you become more reflective and more informed. I think most people are, anti-establishment between the ages, or have their own views to 18 and 24. I think the monarchy's got a job to do. I think that Her Majesty, the late Majesty Queen Elizabeth, was a great store, a huge, very important person on the world stage, and did a very, very, very good job. And I think the current King is doing as best as he can, given his limitations and the fact he's living with cancer. But look, it's up to now William and Kate, really, as the primary movers in all this, to ensure that they do the best job they can, which I believe they are doing, and keep people understanding that monarchy is part of our political system, it's part of our whole system, and unless you want to change the whole system, and I don't know, have Tony Blair as president, which I couldn't think of anything worse, then having a politician as a president, the system... is working, as my old late nan used to say, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Well, they are trying to fix it, aren't they? What was not broke was the Queen sort of glided about in a cloud of pastel loveliness, almost like an old Hollywood star, on a plinth, not really a human being, something bigger than that. And William and Kate, you know, as whatever you might think of how nice they are as people, they just don't have that mystique, do they?
I think that's, yeah, I can see why you're saying that, and I understand your perspective, but I think, number one, the Queen didn't just waft around in a wave of pastel loveliness. I think she's a very active head of state, and I think if you talk to any of the prime ministers she worked with over the 70 years she was on the throne, I think most people think she was a very good head of state. I think that it's trying to understand what the monarchy is about, really, and I think that that's up to William to try and establish what he, going forward, but the, you know, what he wants it to be. But at the moment, the king, as far as I'm aware, the king is the man who's the king, and Charles III is the one who's at the helm, so it's up to him.
Yes, but what do you think of, I know this is slightly off topic, but it's really sort of all of a piece.
Mm.
The glamour has gone with the Queen. I mean, Charles may be many things, but glamorous is not one of them. What they did have...
I probably disagree with that, but I think you only have to look at the Trump visit and see... I think Catherine was actually on a good... She played blind the whole trip, and I think there was glamour there. I think there was.
Well, yes, at that banquet, there was absolutely, it was glamour by the skip load. But the person who really was glamorous and the pair that really did have a sparkle about them, they've gone now. How do you think that the royal family have handled the Meghan and Harry issue?
Badly. I think that Meghan and Harry had great potential for the royal family, and I think it's a shame what happened. But what's happened's happened. You can't cry over spilt milk. I think the reality is that he wanted out. Everyone seems to blame Meghan for that, but I think primarily Harry wanted out. And you've now got someone from the outside, you know, attacking the institution. I think that has been very damaging, just as damaging, maybe not quite as damaging, but on a par with what Prince Andrew's done.
And do you think that all of what we're talking about can be expected to be forgotten in a few years, and the royal family will be, back at the top of the polls and in the nation's heart? Can they reverse this and sort of reverse out of all this bad publicity?
Yeah, I think they can. It's a long corridor. But, I mean, you've got to remember, I mean, I've been covering this for 35 years. I've put them up other things amongst other jobs that I did as a journalist. But I think that they've got a pretty difficult task ahead of them, because the population of this country are not going to just be in any way deferential. You look at the makeup of people in the 1950s when the late Queen Elizabeth came to the throne, and they're believing that, you know, she was appointed by God and things. You know, there's a very different society we lived in then, and I think that it's up to really William, really going forward, to work out what that means for him and what it means for the king to guide his son at this stage. Personally, I think that nothing is guaranteed.
Very good to talk to you, Robert. Thanks so much for that. That's Robert Jobson, royal editor for The Standard and author of Our King, Charles III, The Man and the Monarch Revealed. Now we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be talking to our US correspondent.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Health experts have warned against using weight loss jabs as a quick fix to deal with obesity, whilst 2.5 million people are now on them. This morning, have they helped you?
Richard Spur on LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's Cufflink. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
Welcome on board this LNER service from London King's Cross to Edinburgh. My name's Paul, your train manager today, and hang on. Is that a Scrabble tournament in Coach here? Yes. G with an X is a word. Right, we're cruising at 125 miles per hour. Same speed this lad next to me is typing. Someone's on a roll. The cafe bar's in Coach G if you fancy a brew. Or if you're mid-box set binge, just order through the QR code at your seat. We'll deliver it. So sit back and enjoy your journey. With LNER, it's freedom all the way.
There's some naughty folks out there in cyberspace, and it can be tough to tell a legit deal from a dodgy one. That's why you need Bitdefender, your very own digital heavyweight, working silently behind the scenes to keep you and your devices safe. Whatever threats the web throws at you. Trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Off to America to talk to our US correspondent, which is Andrew Feinberg, the White House correspondent for The Independent, joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Nick.
Let's talk about China first, shall we? This latest episode in this bizarre, destructive tariff war. Donald Trump has now said he's going to slap 100% on top of the tariffs that are already applied to Chinese goods from, I think it's November the 11th, is it not? What's been the reaction in America?
Something like that. It's the reaction, at least in the stock markets, has not been good, and it's sort of a feeling of deja vu all over again, because anytime China does something that the president doesn't like with respect to their own trade policies, the president's impulse is to punish Americans by taxing them more. Tell me how that makes sense, because I don't know.
But that's not the way he's selling it, though, is he? He's not selling it as a tax on Americans. He's still, I don't know whether he believes it or whether he just assumes that his fans will believe it, that he says that he's taxing the other country, that China is the one paying these tariffs.
Yeah, he's always described tariffs as if they're an entry fee paid for the privilege of having Americans buy your products, but that's never how tariffs have worked. And it's never been really clear if he actually believes that or if it's just a blatant lie that he tells to justify what he's doing. He once told me that the idea that Americans pay tariffs, because tariffs, of course, are a tax on imports, was something made up by people who don't like tariffs, but that's literally what tariffs are. And it does not really compute for anyone who knows what they're talking about. But he really banks on people not paying attention. But this is the sort of bluster without thinking that has defined his trade policy. He seems to think that China needs the U.S. just as much as the U.S. needs Chinese raw materials. But that's not really true right now.
Yes. I mean, if it was going to go down to a war, it appears that China has already won, because as America retreats from the world, as it, pulls in its tentacles, then China just occupies the empty space in Europe and Africa particularly. And all of the ground that has been ceded by Trump is just playing into China's hands. It's as though they've won.
Well, I don't want to say who's up, who's down, but it is counterintuitive that you would react this way. And it's typical of Trump, where he takes everything as a personal slight, and everything is built on personal relationships. His idea is if he gets along with a leader, then the U.S. gets along with that country. That's not really how it's ever worked, especially with China, where their government really thinks long term. And at least our government, under the current and past president, dating back to his first term, has only really thought about the next 4-year plan, as in what's going to help his party win the next election. And so it's really a mismatch of strategies in terms of having a strategy versus the U.S. not really having a strategy.
And $2 trillion got knocked off U.S. stocks on Friday, and people are expecting panic selling on Monday. all for what is supposedly a negotiating tactic. And crypto is down 10%. AI could be affected the most because, you know, these rare earth minerals, which is what this latest spat is about, that China is restricting the export of, they're needed for everything in the modern world. And both industries, AI and crypto, are huge Trump funders, and they're really suffering.
Yeah, and that's going to be a big factor in whether or not the president gives himself room to back out of this, because he has made these bold, bellicose threats, and then when he sees what it does to the stock market, and in particular the tech stocks, he has almost always pulled back. And whether or not he does this time really remains to be seen. I would also point out, by the way, that there is a pending court battle over whether or not he has the authority to unilaterally impose these tariffs in the first place. You may recall our respective countries had some unpleasantness around 250 years ago about taxes and things. Mm. And the way that ended up was the people on this side of the pond wrote a constitution that reserved the power to tax, including tariffs, for Congress. And there are some lawsuits that have been working their way through the courts, which have said, hey, the president can't do that. And thus far, the courts have said, yeah, you're right. But as the administration has appealed, those decisions have been put on hold. But watch this space, as they say.
Well, yes, I mean, you're about to get a nationwide No Kings protest, which is a sort of an update of exactly that thing. Let's talk about the shutdown. I mean, Trump has taken the opportunity.
I would advise His Majesty not to take it too personally. We're not talking about him.
Right. And of the shutdown, I mean, Trump's taking the opportunity to fire government workers that would hurt the Democrat Party the most. He's just gutted the Center for Disease Control. What could possibly go wrong?
It's unclear to me how that only affects the Democratic Party, because Republicans can get sick too, as I recall from the COVID years. But what's happening here is, the president, rather than do what presidents usually do and enter into negotiations, he has decided that he's going to outsource all of the negotiation, or not negotiating, as it were, to House Republicans, not exhibit any leadership, and instead use the opportunity to fire workers at agencies that are perceived to be supported more by Democrats. And so far, it's hit things like the CDC and also the Department of Education, parts of it that deal with funding for children with learning disabilities, stuff like that. And it's as if there's no real understanding that the children of Republicans sometimes have learning disabilities as well. And you can expect there's going to be some reaction to this on Capitol Hill from members of Congress who are suddenly going to be facing angry calls from constituents who can't access services because the people who do these things have been fired. And there's, like with everything Trump has done, also pending litigation to stop these reductions in force, as they are called, because a lapse in funding does not mean that they need to fire people. It never has, and we'll see what the courts say on that. Again, watch this space.
How do you think the Democrats have played this? Because it appears as though they're still operating to a rule book that has been torn up, thrown away, and set on fire by Donald Trump. They still are trying to be polite and work with those on the opposite side of the House. And, you know, part of the shutdown, the reason for it, is that the Democrats want to maintain the ability of the poorest Americans to access healthcare. Now, the poorest Americans who access healthcare are mostly in Republican states. So the Democrats
Correct.
Are shooting themselves in the foot in order to help the opposition. Now, the Republicans would never do that.
You know, it's funny that you put it that way, because there was some talk in Democratic circles that they should not go to the mattresses, as the movie mobsters would say, and fight for these subsidies right now. They should let things happen and let that that pain hit voters, including Republican voters, and let them take it out on the incumbents in next year's election. But what has happened instead is you have a faction of the Democratic Party that is so enraged by everything that Trump has done in the last 9 or 10 months since returning to office, and to be fair, with good reasons for being enraged, not taking into account the fact that Democrats don't control the House or Senate or the White House and really have no power in you know, on the federal level. And so they have demanded that Senate Democrats engage in this performative fight, basically for the sake of fighting. Now, what has gone well is the polling favors Democrats, largely because Republicans are the ones who traditionally get blamed for government shutdowns, because that's been part of their brand for the last few decades. Most, if not all, of the prior government shutdowns have been instigated by Republicans. And also, the idea of fixing these health care subsidies polls very, very well. So in terms of who is winning the argument, Democrats seem to be winning the argument thus far. The problem is that the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, refuses to engage, and the Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, is trying to stay in lockstep with Mike Johnson. And the president, Donald Trump, who is, frankly, from what I understand, inclined to support renewing these tax credits and finding a compromise because it would be another deal he could take credit for, has been focused on trying to chase after a Nobel Peace Prize instead of what is happening in Washington. In fact, he's on a plane to Tel Aviv
sorry to interrupt that, but I'm running out of time, but he's, instead of America First, his attention is elsewhere. And it's just a small point, but I think you misspoke. In mob films, they go to the mat. If they went to the mattress, that would be a different kind of film entirely. Thanks, Andrew. Andrew Feinberg, White House correspondent for The Independent. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Global Player or the new LBC app, on which you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a boatload of podcasts, in amongst which you'll find mine. If you haven't got it, it's free. Get it from your app store now. Coming up at 4, it's LBC, it's Ian Payne, but now Richard Spur.
Good morning. Still to come, we'll talk more about the fact that women and girls over the age of 12 have been banned by a mosque from taking part in a charity fun run. I'd like your reaction, and I'll be asking if you feel this sets a worrying precedent for Britain today. But first, around 2.5 million people are using weight loss jabs in the UK. Now, it's something which I've considered on many occasions, and I don't mind telling you, despite the inflated price, I am on the verge of going for it. So I want to hear from you. Sales of Mounjaro and Wegovy reached their level in July, 2.5 million, 7 times more than the same period last year. Now, the Ozempic-style drugs are set to be made widely available. We hear on the NHS under plans drafted by Wes Streeting, but they keep saying that about stuff on the NHS, and it never happens. But they're currently rare on a free prescription, and many people are choosing to go private, despite those massive price increases. Now, experts a warning against using them as a quick fix. So this morning, have they helped you? 0345 6060973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom,
The Prime Minister is expected to use today's multinational summit on ending the war between Hamas and Israel to call for the momentum of the current ceasefire agreement to be seized. It's being held at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt and will be co-hosted by Donald Trump and the Egyptian president on the same day the remaining living Israeli hostages are due to be released from captivity in Gaza. The development's being created by Washington's peace plan for the Middle East, but the former IDF spokesman, Jonathan Conricus, has been telling LBC Hamas remains an obstacle to a meaningful peace.
Hamas isn't an organization that has any intentions whatsoever of coexistence or peace. They are a jihadi organization, and they simply put want to kill the Jews and annihilate Israel. So as long as Hamas exists on paper or in reality, peace is not in the cards.
The Conservative leader's written to Sir Keir Starmer demanding answers about why a case against two alleged Chinese spies collapsed. Last week, the Director of Public Prosecution said it was abandoned because evidence describing Beijing as a national security threat couldn't be obtained from Labour. The government is blaming the previous Tory administration. There are new suggestions Prince Andrew was in contact with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein for much longer than he'd previously claimed. A new email's been published which appears to show the Duke of York telling the disgraced financier, "We're in this together." Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. The royal editor at the London Standard, Robert Jobson, has been telling LBC, "Too many questions remain."
Any cover-up, it seems to me, is worse than sometimes worse than the deeds. The trouble is, in this instance, we really don't know what the deeds were because nobody's actually been forced to testify in this case. We're in a bit of a dilemma as we watch on. My feeling is it's a bit of a reckoning for Andrew, and it's put the king in an invidious position.
A new push against hate crimes is beginning in Northern Ireland. Police there say nearly 2,300 of them were reported in the 12 months up until June. And scientists are warning the world has reached its first climate tipping point. More than 160 of them from 23 countries have published a report. It says warm water coral reefs, which nearly a billion people and a quarter of all marine life depend on, have already passed their thermal limits. LBC weather, mostly dry and largely clear in the west overnight. Cloudier for eastern areas with patchy fog across England and Scotland. We'll see a low of 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Good morning, nice to be back with you. Well, it's something I've been dickering with for a very long time, and I'm almost about to take the plunge, although actually, for some reason, goodness knows what, I have managed to lose a little bit of weight recently. The belt is down to 3 notches, I'll have you know. But in the news this morning, health experts are now warning against using weight loss jabs as a quick fix to help deal with the obesity crisis. With more than 2.5 million people in the UK now on weight loss drugs Mounjaro and Wegovy, there are growing fears that doctors will prescribe the jabs rather than tackling broader issues of junk food and promoting healthy lifestyles. Well, fat chance of that, if you'll excuse the expression. Because as far as I know, it's getting them on prescription is like trying to find hen's teeth. Doctors are incredibly reluctant to prescribe them, not least of all because of the cost. And I think unless you've got pretty severe diabetes, there's no way that they'll give them to you, despite what Westreeting may say. Catherine Jenner from the Obesity Health Alliance said that weight loss drugs were only a temporary reprieve from obesity, which is a chronic, long-term condition. It's not the quickness of it that concerns me. It's the long-term effect, she said. Obesity is a chronic, long-term condition, and it's not something that magically goes away. It's not a quick fix. It's a temporary reprieve, she told the Daily Telegraph. And she said she was surprised about how many people were using the latest generation weight loss drugs in the UK. Now, 2.5 million taking them, that's a vast proportion of the adult population, if you work it out. I haven't worked it out exactly. 2.5 million sales of Mounjaro and Wegovy reached in July, 7 times more than the same period last year. And according to the Health Secretary, they will be made widely available on the NHS under plans drafted by him. But I think what will happen is that they'll have to wait until they go to what's called the generic version, which is after a certain period of years when you have a drug that's made by a particular drug company, the patent, whatever it is, expires, and they can then be made by anybody. and made far more cheaply, which is what happens eventually. But in those first years, they can only be made by the company involved. I forget which it is now for those two. They're currently, as I said, very rare on a free prescription, and many people are choosing to go private. And as far as I can tell, talking to friends and listening to you occasionally when you call me about these subjects, it's very easy to get hold of those drugs, Mounjaro and Wegovy. There are various websites that you can go on to. Things like Morrison's, Asda, Pharmacy to You. There are loads of them, absolutely loads. And you put in your details. I think you have to send a picture. You see, I have been doing some research. You have to send your height and your weight and answer a few questions about your lifestyle, just as you would if you were registering with a new GP. And then I think generally they say, yes, please, show me the money and we'll send them in the post to you. Nice and easy. But I've heard this, that in the last month or two, thanks largely, I think, to Mr. Trump, particularly the price of Mounjaro has doubled. So that whereas, you know, you could get one of the maintenance doses for, I don't know, about £170-180 a month, it's now in the region of, you know, sort of £370-380, something like that. So I think for many people, I don't know about you, they will have been moved out of their financial reach. I'd like to hear your story this morning. If you have tried the so-called fat jabs, weight loss drugs that you inject, and what your experience has been like with them. I mean, were they worth the money? It's not cheap. It isn't cheap. You know, anything more than £150 a month is a very large commitment, and particularly now, if it's going up to the region of 360, 370, something like that, that's a lot of money, and you've got to be able to afford them, or I suppose be, you know, really very desperate to lose weight. What's your journey been like with those? Sorry, that's a terribly American term to use, isn't it? Your journey. What's your experience been like if you've been tempted to use fat jabs and have had a go with them? Are they the miracle drugs that people suggest? And what do you make of this warning from health experts, including doctors, that actually, yes, they might provide, you know, pretty effective short-term loss. I mean, people say you can lose up to, what is it, two-thirds of your body weight or something within a year and a half. But when you stop taking them, surely it's just like having been on a diet and then going back to eating, you know, the burgers and the takeaways and drinking the beer and the wine and drinking the full fat Coke. It must come back on again. You know, do they train you? I genuinely want to know this morning, because it's something, as I said to you before, that I'm, you know, I need to lose, I'll be honest with you, I need to lose about 2 or 3 stone, really. Probably, yeah, 2.5, 3 stone. And so it's something that I'm, you know, very tempted to try. But if it's simply just going to be a, you know, a short-term sticking plaster, and then it's all going to come.